to believe. Thanks also always go out to the hardest working people, the bravest people that I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Go there, sign up for the newsletter. That way you'll find out when big things are happening in the struggle for basic Appalachian human rights. crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Our good friend Stuart Akoff, Chief of Staff and Assistant to the President over at the Utility Workers Union of America, going to be here talking about the latest development with the National Labor Relations Board. The righties going to lose their ever-loving freaking minds. Again, the Labor Board has decided that workers have rights, and that companies can't just do things arbitrarily against the contract that they have signed. Heaven forbid we enforce actual contractual law. Heaven forbid. Heaven forbid. I'll also talk about his latest book, Playing Bigger Than You Are, A Life in Organizing, which is available exclusively at levinspublishing.com. Of course, we've always got a link at thericksmithshow.com to our guests and the work that they do. So just click on Stuart Akoff's name, take you right to his book. Also, we're going to talk with Sun Young Chow Morrow, a national organizer for the Interfaith Worker Justice folks, about what's going on in Indiana as the No Rights at Work agenda pushed by the Republicans has moved on to the next phase there in Indiana. It was voted out of committee rather quickly within a couple of minutes. It is the fight of today, so we'll be talking to him about to her about that, and also Professor Robert Ford, the professor of history there at UMass Lowell. He's also the co-director of the Center for Family, Work, and Community. Today, the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Bread and Roses strike up there in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Thousands of immigrant women workers take to the streets to say, you know what, it's one thing to fight for bare subsistence. It's another thing to have a little bit extra, which is why the Bread and Roses strike. They fought for, yes, bread, absolutely. But, you know, something else as well, maybe a little disposable income. You go fast forward 100 years, we're right in the same struggles. It doesn't seem to ever change, does it? You know, before the show, I was thinking of something that Noam Chomsky had said. He was quoting Adam Smith, and he said, if you see two businessmen talking, they're conspiring. And it's true. I mean, they're conspiring to figure out how to put more money in their pocket from yours. And that's why I love what's going on with Mitt Romney, because the Republicans are going after him for what he did. And what he did is what they've been saying is good for the country for years. So it'll be interesting to talk about that. So much more. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I've been thinking since we got back from New Hampshire. And I wanted to thank Dr. Steven Herzenberg and, of course, our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, for coming sitting in last night. It was a travel day back, long drive. And, you know, just needed a little break from the couple of days that were. If you missed any portion of those, they were fantastic days, I think, there in New Hampshire, as we brought you the coverage from the primary there and talked to a number of the crazy people. So it'd be interesting if you can go back and take a look at that. TheRickSmithShow.com is where we have all our podcasts. And also, if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app. But I've been thinking about the Paulian idea of liberty and freedom. And, you know, like I said there, this freedom to trash things. This freedom that, you know, I can do whatever I want. I can consume. I can destroy. It's all about the me, which is why I'm renaming the GOP the GOME. Because it's all about the me. The heck with society, even though we keep throwing that slogan, country first, out there, which is kind of ridiculous. They keep throwing that out there, even though they don't believe it. And then I started taking this to the next level. I started thinking about, well, what about having that freedom, having that liberty? Freedom from want, freedom from need, freedom from not having health care. You know, as I was listening to the rhetoric, you know, we need to undo Obamacare so we can have the freedom not to have health care. We can have the freedom to die. We can have the freedom to pay or die. And as I was coming in today thinking about this, just running it through my head, going, you know, I understand the Paulians, the little Paul bots that I met. You know, 20, 25-year-olds like I was when I was 18, 20, 25, I was invincible. I was bulletproof. Nothing could stop me. You get into your 30s and into your 40s, you start going, well, gee, you know, is that ache or pain? Is that, you know, just a regular ache and pain, or am I going to die from this? And you want to have things checked out. You need to have regular checkups. But at 20, 25, you're not thinking that way. You're not worried about, am I going to have health care, or are my children going to fall and break an arm, and is it going to bankrupt me? You're not thinking about that. You're thinking about trashing the place. You're thinking about going out and getting drunk and throwing up in someone's lobby. Well, maybe you're not thinking about the throwing up part, but that's what you're doing. But the more I thought about them, the more, yeah, that argument, very, very sophomoric, very, very childish, very, very me. But as you get a little bit older, you start thinking, you know, I've got responsibilities. I've got to think about my family. I've got to think about my future, the community. I've got to think about others as well. It's not just about the me. And as I was thinking today, I was thinking about the freedom to be able to start your own business and the freedom to kind of do your own thing, if you will, which is what they're kind of preaching now, which is kind of weird because, you know, during the 60s, that's something they would have been against, I think. But as I was going through this, I'm going, you know, how much better off this country would be if everyone had the ability to follow their passion and start their own small business. I read this statistic last week, and I brought it to you last week, that 90% of the people who work in this country, 90% work for somebody. That means only 10% of the people in this country are the quote-unquote job creators. What if we took health care off the backs of individuals? What if we said, you know what? We're going to let you follow your passions. We're going to let you throw that shingle out there. We're going to let you take that risk and not risk everything you're ever going to have, not risk your family's health, not risk your own health. I had a doctor's appointment today, and I was talking to the doctor. I don't know if it's the doctors have just become very, very right-wing, but I seem to be getting these doctors who, you know, they want to argue the Republican talking points. I mean, I got a Tea Party dentist, so I guess it's no surprise that this other doctor wants to, you know, have the argument on why Medicare is bad. And Medicare, from my perspective, a working class perspective, very good thing. Takes care of my grandmother. She gets the care she needs. It keeps her out of poverty. You know, you stop and you think about it. As a 70-some-year-old woman with very limited means, to have a heart bypass, valve replacement, you know, to have that and then to have to go back into the private market and ask for insurance again, it's never going to happen. And you're going to end up losing everything. And conservative world, that's where they want to put us. They want to put us in the situation where we're basically on our own and the winner takes all and has no responsibility to the rest of the herd. So they come in, they eat up all the food, they leave, and everybody else starves. That's the conservative ideology. So it doesn't surprise me that Mitt Romney, while at Bain Capital, would go in, suck all the assets out of a company, take the pension funds, and then let them off to die. That doesn't surprise me. What is surprising to me is the Republican response so far. The Rick Perrys and the Newt Gingriches, Perry calling him a vulture capitalist. Well, yeah, that's what it's about. It's about capital making more capital. It's not about putting money into that, making those businesses better. That's not what they're meant to do. Capitalists make more capital. They have none whatsoever. They have no responsibility to society. Unless you and I put some rules in the game. But I guess we're not going to do that. And you know, we also have the freedom. And I was thinking about this on the way home the other night. I was really, and maybe you were as taken back as I was, how little the Republicans actually understood up there about this no rights at work agenda that they're pushing. I was shocked. I was amazed at how little they were able to push back. Because there are some very rational arguments for their position. They just don't know them. All they know is, I've been told by my hierarchy that this is where we need to go to make the party stronger. Understand, killing your right to organize at work makes their party stronger, they think. It's what they think. They don't understand all the nuance. All they know is what they've been told is bad. And I came across this post on one of the show's friends' blogs. It's this Lawyers, Guns, and Money blog, lawyersgunsandmoneyblog.com. He writes, he came across this article from the International Woodworker from back in 1958. And I guess they were pursuing the same things that they're trying to do today. So someone wrote an editorial into this magazine. And it was this woman named Patricia Bolin. Her husband was a carpenter at the time. And she wrote, I poo-pooed the right to work when the right to work was first called a man-killer. But it is, she says. The man I loved is being killed by it. He's a carpenter, strong, capable, hardworking, and able to do three men's work, which he does. Thereby, he keeps his job, luckier than most carpenters these days. He retains his job by doing man-killing work, but the rest of his crew is fired each Friday. A fresh group is brought in on Monday. There's no longer a union steward whose job it used to be to see that the company provided fresh drinking water, toilet facilities, a place to change and keep dry clothes, safety precautions, and so on. She says her man comes home each day thirsty, soaking wet, and heart sick because eager, hardworking family men on the job are being laid off when they can't double or triple their output. She says this is not an isolated case. She says, I'm a school teacher. I address this to other teachers, office workers, business people, and others who know firsthand what the Handley Law really is, a right to work a man to death law. She said, I plead for its repeal. Now, you know, Handley obviously was the Republican governor of Indiana at the time, who said he wasn't going to sign it. He allowed it to be passed into law. And you go now and you look at, Republicans are still trying to do the exact same thing, ramming this down the workers' throats so that they have no voice. And this is just one letter, and I'm sure there are thousands if you go back and you read some of these accounts. You know, I think about education and child labor. When I was doing research for the Labor History Minutes, I came across one of the robber barons saying, well, you know, I've seen children spoiled for work by too much education. Yeah, you know, because they were never going to rise up and be anything more than a laborer, so they shouldn't be able to think. They shouldn't be able to read and write and be critical thinkers, because that's dangerous to the investor class. And I think of an old, you know, an old carpenter's saying. You know, the ships are going to sail. I may never sail on it, but I'm going to build it anyway. You know, with the idea that, you know what, I'm going to work for today because tomorrow this is going to work. Tomorrow it's going to be better for my children and my grandchildren. I don't know if we have that mentality anymore, that we're thinking about tomorrow and the next generation. Again, I think the people over at the GeoMe have got us in the mindset that for me now, fast, quick, for my consumption and me, me, me. Anyway, quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Drowning in crowds and lies. Saving USA. Every single time is mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job you're working for.
Saving work in America. One show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Working America is urging the White House and all 50 state attorneys general to hold big banks accountable for the mortgage crisis and not let them off with what amounts to a slap on the wrist. Working America's Christian Norton.
Mortgage banks and the state attorney generals are in a conversation right now to try to work out a settlement, basically to hold them accountable for the fraudulent mortgage practices that really put us in this economic strife that we're in right now. And we want to make sure that we get the best possible settlement for workers. This is really one of our last chances to get real relief for working families. There's about 7.5 million homes that are in the foreclosure process and another 11 million at risk. So the settlement has to make sure that it takes into account all of those families. It needs to be real accountability. And if we just go with a slap on the wrist, you know, that's not going to really help the working families. We need to have a full accountability. We need to have real relief.
A major Chinese manufacturing facility for Apple and Microsoft apparently is treating workers so poorly that they're resorting to suicide threats. Jesse Russell reports.
Workers at a Foxconn plant in Wuhan, China, have threatened mass suicide after the company announced they would be denying a pay increase. Foxconn builds electronic products for numerous worldwide corporations, such as Apple and Microsoft, and this plant specifically produces the popular gaming console Xbox 360. The employees were given the option of keeping their jobs without a pay raise or resigning from their jobs and receive compensation in exchange. After the workers quit their jobs and no payout materialized, 300 workers reportedly went to the factory, climbed to the roof, and threatened to jump. After a day-long standoff, the workers were eventually coaxed down by the mayor of Wuhan. Microsoft has said it will launch an investigation into the working conditions at the Chinese factory. Foxconn has a long history of violating codes of conduct it has in place with U.S. companies. In 2010, it was recorded that at the least 14 workers committed suicide due to labor conditions. The company produces numerous products, including Amazon's Kindle, Apple's iPods and iPhones, and the Nintendo Wii.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. Think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I got to be honest, you know, as I was up in New Hampshire, I was expecting at the, you know, the events that we saw, more voters, a lot of media people, a lot of people with cameras, a lot of small independent blogger types, a lot of folks out there trying, you know, doing some reporting from the spot, which I think is fantastic. And the question then becomes is, you know, what do we want from our media? And I saw this story over at the New York Times just kind of made me wonder. And you would think that this is the kind of headline you would expect from The Onion or something like this. But this is the New York freaking Times. Should the Times be a truth vigilante? You know, should we go after and report what these candidates say and then find reality? Or should we just be stenographers for the political class? I mean, one of the things you could say during the Bush years is the mainstream corporate-controlled media were basically just stenographers of the Bush administration, and probably even worse than that. They just took what the Bush administration already prepackaged, already wrote, already produced, already, well, did their jobs for them, and they passed it off as their own work. There used to be a word for that when I was in school, but evidently plagiarism doesn't matter. I guess it's not really plagiarism if you take somebody else's work and pass it off as your own. There's another word for that, I'm sure. But they're asking the question, you know, should we be truth vigilantes? And he asks, I'm looking for readers' input on whether and when New York Times reporters should challenge facts that are asserted by the newsmakers they write. And, you know, my first thought was no. They should just go ask another paper. Go ask the New York Post. Get your news from the Post. Or why not, you know, the National Enquirer or the Star or one of the tabloid papers? Because they tend to do a little bit of that. And he goes in, he says, well, you know, you got these op-ed columns that, you know, they do that. You know, that's kind of their gig. And as I'm looking at it, I'm going, well, wait a second. There's a huge difference between an opinion page, an op-ed. There's a huge difference between here's my opinion, here's what he said, these are what I see as the facts, and this is how I see it going. There's a difference between that and saying, well, this is what he said on the trail, this is what he said maybe 6 months ago. This is what so-and-so says, and presenting both sides of the story. There is, maybe they taught that in journalism school, maybe they didn't. I'm thinking they probably taught it, and these folks were just absent that day. Maybe that's the best way to describe it. Maybe they were just absent that day. And, because what I don't want, this right-wing hit squad media, and I can, you know, there's part of me that says I can understand why you asked the question. Do you just want reporters going out there and saying, this is what happened? Decide for yourself. Go find your own facts. You know, should they report, you know, when Mitt Romney says I created 100,000 jobs, should they ask which 100,000 jobs you're talking about? And should they bring up the fact that he's probably destroyed hundreds of thousands of jobs as well? I mean, should that be part of the reporting? And I kind of get that argument. But to come out and say, well, do you really want us to be vigilantes for the truth? Do you want us to do that? And, just lie to me. Lie to me. I want to go through life in a fog. I want those rose-colored glasses that tells me everything is just peachy. Like during the Bush years. I'd like to go back to the Bush years and be lied to by my media, and I want them to hold stories so it's politically advantageous for the candidates. That's what I want from my media. I want shiny things. I want bread and circus. I want the runaway bride. I want scandal. You know, I want sex scandal. Give me who's cheating on who. Give me who. You know, Britney Spears, I guess, is back in the news. Her fans are arguing if someone didn't transpose her head onto a skinnier body. That's hard-hitting news. That's what I need more of. Don't worry about those job losses. Don't worry about the unemployment. Nah, that's depressing. Give me happy stuff. Give me pictures of kittens frolicking in the summer fields. That would make my life so much better, I think. So I look at this guy, James O'Keefe, who, again, you know, starts off with a premise, and this is what I don't want in my media. I don't want someone who's going to start with the conclusion and work his way backwards, which is he started this latest scheme off with, we need to make sure that people know that there's a voter fraud problem with people not showing their driver's licenses. So what he did, and I'm hoping this gets him into a bunch of trouble, because it should. To me, this is voter fraud at its height. He went with some of his camera people, put them little undercover cameras on their clothes like he does, you know, these hit jobs. He goes into the polling place on Tuesday. He didn't, but he sent others in. He sent his surrogates in, because I don't think he's allowed to leave New Jersey, I think it is, because of the last stunt he pulled that got him into hot water with the law. So he sends these doofuses in to say there's some dead guy. My name is blah, blah, blah. And they know blah, blah, blah died a week or 2 weeks or 2 months ago. So they go in and they, and this is the funny part. They go up to the, and this is their argument why they shouldn't get into trouble, by the way. They go in and they carefully word their statement. And they ask the woman behind, who's got the book with all the names, and anybody who's voted knows, you walk up and you say, you know, Rick Smith, and they go to the page, oh yeah, is that right there, sign there. So they walk up and they say, do you have blah, blah, blah? Or do you have so-and-so? And they turn to the page and, yep, right there, okay, here's your ballot. Oh, no, 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 I don't want the ballot now. You know, do I need a photo ID? No, you don't need a photo ID. You just need to tell us who you are. You need to represent who you are by saying, do you have so-and-so? And then they go, well, I forgot my ID. I'm going to go run out to the car. And the poll worker goes, ah, who cares? But they videotaped all this stuff. Now, understand, in New Hampshire, that's against the law. And they're also saying on the federal level, it may also be against the law as well. So not only could they be facing state charges, they could be facing federal charges as well. In New Hampshire, someone who commits voter fraud, as these, in my opinion, these people were doing, they lose their right to vote forever. That's on top of whatever fines or whatever jail time they get. They lose their right forever. And that should probably be the punishment everywhere. If you're dumb enough to do something like this, not only should you get smacked, but you should do some time in jail so you get smacked every day there, and you should never be allowed near a voting booth again. But again, the whole point here is, well, this is why we need photo ID, because there's a flaw in our system. And I went back and I looked at the results, okay? Mitt Romney got 39.3% of the vote. He got 97,533 votes. Ron Paul got 56,848 votes, 22.9%. Huntsman got 41,945 votes. Gingrich got 23,411. Rick Santorum got 23,362. They sent three people around a couple of different polling places. At best, 10 people would have done this. Nowhere in here would 10 votes matter that much, wouldn't have that much of an impact. But stop and think about the punishment. If you're caught, you can never vote again in your life. That's on top of going to jail and being fined. Remember the old Beretta TV show? Does anybody remember that? Do the crime, do the time. To me, the time that you would do, the punishment that you would get, is far, far beyond the reward that you're going to get for committing this senseless act. Now, they argue, oh, we just wanted to highlight the fact, oh. Personally, I don't get it. It's just dumb. Because it would not have altered the outcome one bit. And they seem to think that people are, and in fact, there was an instance where the poll worker, and they don't go into this in their little video, but the poll worker actually said, wait a minute, that person died. That's not you. They didn't report that, though. They didn't get into that. The Boston Herald had to report that. The system, I think, is fine the way it is, because there are only a handful of these idiots running around. I say what we do, and I think it's probably a good idea. Get rid of them. Lock them up. But this is what O'Keefe does. This is what that kind of the bizarre media does. It's a bunch of hit jobs. They start with their end, and they work their way backwards. That's not the kind of reporting I want. So, if the Times is asking, do we do the James O'Keefe stuff? No. I say do actual reporting, follow the candidates, follow what they say, but you know what? Fact check it. That seems reasonable. There's my opinion. Let's take a quick break. Your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Let's hear it for American Tradition Partnership. It's an organization that stands up for the politically dispossessed in our land. It goes to the highest courts to assert the fundamental rights of a minority that's been denied its full voice in America's political and governmental power circles. Yes, American Tradition Partnership is a tenacious advocate for, cue the patriotic music, corporations. Huh? Despite its grandiose name, American Tradition Partnership is a front group that funnels money from corporations into various political ads attacking candidates whom the corporations don't like, without identifying the corporate backers. Hoping to expand its laundry services for these secret donors, ATP filed suit in Montana to overturn the state's century-old ban on spending corporate funds in state and local elections. The front group argued that the ban restricts corporate influence over government policies. Wow, that's so twisted and anti-democratic that it'd make an American eagle scream in pain. But for arrogant corporate elites and their political lackeys, too much is never enough. The good news is that corporate lackeys don't yet control Montana's Supreme Court. On December 30th, the court's majority sided with democracy, common sense, and State Attorney General Steve Bullock, who argued for the people of Montana that corporations already have beaucoup ways to assert their oversized political power without needing to funnel secret money into our elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the front group will now scamper to the corporate-friendly U.S. Supreme Court, pleading with it to stomp on this victory for democracy by overruling the state court and the people of Montana. To keep posted on this case and to fight for people power over corporate rule, go to www.freespeechforpeople.org. Freespeechforpeople.org.
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you, the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org or call 1-866-271-4900.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Ever check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the president proposed tax breaks for companies that decide that they want to bring their manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. He also says, you know what, if you're going to continue to outsource jobs, we're going to end those tax breaks, something we should have done right from the beginning. It makes absolutely no sense. And no one I've ever talked to can come up with a rational explanation of how it is we've allowed these big corporations to move jobs overseas and to have us pay for them. It's kind of like having someone break into my house and me renting the moving van for them to move all my stuff out. It's the same thing. They're going to open my doors, they're going to take all my stuff out, and I'm going to pay for the vehicle to do it. Probably going to end up paying for the labor, pay them by the hour to take my stuff out. So it would be a good idea to stop this. It would have been a good idea to stop it a year ago, 2 years ago, 10 years ago. It would have been a good idea to stop it from the beginning, but at least this guy's talking about it. Now, this idea of tax breaks to bring jobs back, on a very short term, I'm in favor of it. But at the end of the day, what has to happen, in my estimation, is we've got to start talking about nations again. We've got to start talking about local again. We need to put up barriers around. I'm not an isolationist, but I do believe in locking my door when I leave so nobody steals my stuff. I do believe in protecting what is yours. I do believe in protecting industry that we need, vital to our national security. The ability to produce energy, the ability to produce steel, the technological ability to make computers and machine parts, and all of the things that you need. If we're going to be a war society, we should be able to have the not only the productive capacity, but also the human intellect to be able to do this. We shouldn't have to go, China, time out. Can you send us over some more of those smart chips so we can use them to bomb you? We shouldn't have to do that. And this is one of those areas where I think Democrats and Republicans can really come together, except that the Republicans are bought and paid for by big business. And to a lesser extent, so are the Democrats. But there's an opportunity here, I think, for people, not politicians, for people to bridge the gap between my team is the Republican team and my team is the Democrat team. There's an opportunity to bridge that. And this is where I think Tea Party people, who are still semi-lucid, you can talk to. Because I don't think anyone thinks what's going on is putting us in the right direction. And what I find really interesting about the Republican candidates, this total, complete lack of vision of where this country is going to go. None of them has a plan that a majority of economists, I'm not even thinking majority, just a minor minority, are agreeing is the direction we need to go. So we're not hearing the vision. There aren't a lot of details. It's real sketchy. It's the same stuff. We need to cut taxes. We need to deregulate. We need to be more business friendly. You know, nice big thoughts so they can walk around in there. But what it really seems that all they're willing to do is beat up on Obama. And all this election is about for Republicans is how do we get that black guy out of the White House? It's not about making workers' lives better. It's not about making the citizens of this country's life better. No, it has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with how do we get that guy out of the White House. And I find it really interesting that it's Romney and it's Gingrich and it's Huntsman and the right who are going after Romney. Gingrich told NBC about Romney's business expertise over at Bain Capital. He says, you know, they apparently looted the companies, left people totally unemployed, and walked off with millions of dollars. Gingrich went on to say, look, I'm for capitalism. But if somebody comes in, takes all the money out of your company and leaves you bankrupt while they go off with millions, that's not traditional capitalism. So now he's all for capitalism, but wait a second, got to put the caveat, that's not traditional capitalism. No, Newt, that's exactly what your model preaches. Hooray for me, screw you. That's capitalism. Embrace it for what it is. Be honest. And there are some Republicans, there are some right-wingers who are coming out saying, yes, that's exactly the system that we are going to defend. I should have the right to, with my assets and my money and my leverage, to take your stuff and throw you out in the street as long as you're willing to accept the pittance that we're going to give you. Because if you remember back during the 80s especially, these corporate raiders would come in and they'd make their fat cat buddy investors all richer, and the companies just stand there going, what about us? Oh, you employees? Sorry. Thanks a lot. Thanks for making the company worth at least something so we could steal the assets from it. And you look at what's going on right now, and Reuters did a nice piece on this. Majority of the economists that they talked to said Romney doesn't have a clear idea, doesn't really have an idea for the recovery, doesn't have a way of getting this economy moving. He's proposed a lot of the same right-wing, you know, deep spending cuts, which I don't know how that's going to help the economy. Smaller government, which, you know, what does that mean? Does that mean we want ineffective government? We don't want anybody watching the store? Yes. Trade penalties on China, I kind of agree with. I want to know what the penalties are. Very vague there. Will they have to, you know, will they have to only send half of the rancid fish? I want to know what the details are. He wants a new Fed chairman. And deregulation. Again, more deregulation. And look, he's gotta throw the red meat over to the radicals. And if you've seen some of the people we saw in New Hampshire, it was pretty amazing. The people who came in were really way out there. Because that's what he's gotta do. He's gotta get crazy. I'm surprised he hasn't already said he wants to go back to the gold standard. I'm surprised that hasn't fallen out of his mouth trying to take it from Ron Paul. He wants to be the cut, gut, and punish guy to make the T-Twits happy. And I think most of these economists that they talked to, what they said is, look, now what he'll do in reality, he's talking the T-talk now. He's talking the Paul talk now. But 2013, that could be a different story. When he gets into office, don't worry about it. He'll be okay. And that's the rational part of the Republican Party going, you know, don't worry about it. He's going to be okay. He's just saying this stuff to influence the doofuses so that they'll support him in the primaries. And then we can moderate a little bit. And I'm telling the folks on the radical doofus base, that's what they got planned for you. It's coming. But I look at what, Jamie Galbraith, who is a professor at the University of Texas in Austin, and he says that what Romney wants to do is shrink the size of federal government down to where it was before Reagan, which would be catastrophic. He says if applied, his fiscal measures would be utterly draconian. The attacks on Medicare and Social Security would throw large portions of the population into poverty, and it would be draconian. It would be harmful to this economy. And you look at the numbers of people who are falling into poverty still. They tell us we're out of the recession. We have a slow recovery going on. We're out of the recession. Things are moving in the right direction. Yet nearly 10 million more Americans have fallen into poverty. The folks over at the School for Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, they released a study on Wednesday. They found that in 2010, poverty numbers shot up to 46.2 million people. There are 46.2 million people in this country living in poverty. In 2006, before the whole Bush collapse happened, you had 36.5 million people. So you're talking nearly 10 million more people in poverty because of this recession, this massive redistribution of wealth from these folks upward. Now, what they're saying is, look, poverty's going to continue. It's going to continue because this recovery is not creating any wealth at the bottom. And you look at what's going on Wall Street, you look at the stacks of money, that the mountains of money that they're sitting on, the revenues, the profits, the bonuses, they're well off. It's the working people who continually get screwed. It's those folks who are busting their behind trying to make ends meet who are getting screwed. And now we hear the Republicans going on and on about, well, you know, those working people, you know, they're just mooching off the government with those food stamps. They should have to do with less. And their ideology is the same. It's those people. But understand, there are 46.2 million of those people. If only we could get those 46.2 million people to go to the polls and tell these Republicans, I'm not lazy. I want opportunity. I want jobs. I want an environment where jobs are created. I don't want division. I don't want divisiveness. I don't want gridlock. I don't want what the Republicans have brought us. Because, again, they have no plan. Their plan is division. Their plan is divisiveness. And if they can keep pointing their fingers at Obama and say, see, he isn't creating jobs, never mind the fact that they're obstructing and delaying and that they have no plan, it's the same thing. More tax cuts for the rich, more deregulations for big corporations, regulations on you and me, and more tax cuts for businesses. That's their plan. Has it worked? Has it worked in the 30 years they've been preaching it? The answer is no. When we come back, I want to talk about this concept that they keep throwing out. We are a classless society. Your thoughts after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Yes, I'm working all the time. It seems to me I can live my life a lot better than I think I am. I guess that's why they call me the working man. Working man, working man, working man.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky. Desalination is the process of taking the salt out of ocean water to convert it into drinking water. An Earth Sky listener asked why desalination isn't in greater use along the U.S. coast, like California, where water scarcity is an issue. As yet, no full-scale desalination plant, that is a plant that produces millions of gallons of fresh water each day, has been built there. We spoke to Heather Cooley, co-director of the water program at the Pacific Institute. She told us the answer is complicated. Desalination has one huge plus, she said. It relies on plentiful seawater.
It's not dependent on local climate conditions. In addition, water produced from seawater desalination is very high quality. It's very pure water.
But she added, desalination can have drawbacks. For instance, she said, desalination plants can cost millions to billions of dollars to build.
But a lot of the cost is also in operating the facility. It also is very energy intensive, and that raises issues associated with the cost, but it also raises concerns about greenhouse gas emissions.
Cooley explained that it takes a lot of power to run a desalination plant because seawater, in order to be purified, is typically pushed through filters or membranes at very high pressure. But she added, the technology is improving. Desalination is controversial. For more viewpoints, come to our website and search on desalination. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Rich and poverty. Bought a shirt that came on. Blue denim had his vape.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast from the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone and take the program on the go. The number here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you got any thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind, this idea that we're a classless society. The wealth class has done a masterful job of pushing that frame out there. We're a classless society. We're not like those people over in Europe. They're a class society. We're definitely not. Because you, as a working stiff, you can go into the same restaurant and eat right next to Warren Buffett. And you can go play golf at the best country clubs. Well, no, skip that. Skip the golf one. But you can drive on the same streets. You can fly on the same air. Well, no, you can't fly in the same airports because they've got their own private airports. But you can definitely walk around, you know, in pub. Well, they have their gated communities. But we're classless, completely classless. We're a classless society, except for the politicians who keep pandering to this thing called the middle class. Unless I missed this, we are a classless society with a middle class. Anybody with an answer for that? Because I can't think of it. So what they've done, and they've done a masterful job at trying to repair that middle class thing, and they've changed the words. And they're good at this. They're very cognizant of words. They know that words have meaning. So when they preach that we're a classless society and then turn around and use the word middle class, I think they see the ridiculousness of this statement. So they've now come up with middle income. We're a classless society, but we have middle income. So you have higher income, lower income, and the middle income. But I think the American people have figured this thing out. Because according to yesterday's Pew Research poll, they believe now, according to the poll, more Americans believe that there is class conflict going on. There's class war. And it's the rich and the poor. More folks now, 66%, say that they either strongly view or very strong or strongly view the conflict between the rich and poor, which is a 19% increase from 2 years ago. I look at this and I go, what took you so long? The poll says the greatest increase came from the middle income Americans. Gotta love how they've taken on to that. Between 40,000 and 75,000, a jump from 47 to 71%. And do you know why that middle income group is finally getting the fact that class war is happening? Because they are now falling from 75 down to 40. And those people who were in the 50 range are down into the 35 range. People are falling out of the middle income. And as I've said for the longest time, I don't care what you do for a living. I don't care if you drive a truck, dig a ditch, teach a class, pick your nose. As long as you're trading time for wages, you are a working person. And you cannot be in the Buffett class. You cannot be in the Gates class or the investor class or people who sit on their yachts and trade stock and make their living off of capital gains, which, again, another magical thing our tax code does, because you're trading your life for a couple of bucks to feed your family. They're gambling. And they pay less tax than you do. And we've somehow said yes. We've somehow supported people who put this out there and said, yes, we want a society where gamblers pay less than someone who goes and trades the hours of his day or her day or life away in return for wages. And they keep ramming it down our throats. Well, you don't need to have any say in what happens in those hours. You can't say how much those hours are worth. Can't do that collectively. But, you know, they love pushing this frame that you can go and negotiate for yourself. Make your own deal. And I was thinking about, you know, the worker going to Walmart, who's a career retail employee, has been doing it for 15, 20 years, going, you know, I understand retail. I understand product placement. I understand basic marketing. I've got a two-year associate's degree. I'm going to go negotiate my price to go work at Walmart. They walk in, they sit down for the interview, and I'm here to negotiate my price. And the person at Walmart says, well, you'll make $9 an hour, no health care, and no pension. Take it or leave it. But I'd like to negotiate. Take it or leave it. Would you like to negotiate with that? That's your negotiation power. And at no point do you have the ability to say, well, I'd like better hours, I'd like better benefits, I'd like better pay, I'd like a portion of the profit that I create. Now, my grandmother, her generation got that. The place that she worked at, the workers formed a union, collective bargaining contract, said, you know what, our time is worth something. Corporate profits come in, we'd like a portion of that. In 1985, when she retired, she was making $8 an hour, 6 weeks vacation, full paid health care, eye, dental, and a pension plan that she collects to this day. That was 1985. People working in that industry right now barely make $8 an hour. They don't get 6 weeks vacation. They don't get paid holidays. They don't get paid days off. They don't get their birthday off. They don't get health care or pensions. They might get a 401k that maybe they match a penny or two to. But that's it. And why is that? That's because the workers' ability to say we're going to collectively bargain is being taken away. And we're seeing this attack on the working people of this country. We're seeing this attack on the middle class. We're seeing people being squeezed out. There was a study back in November, and we talked about it, that found that people who are rich and poor have grown more isolated. Rich people live in their gated communities. Poor people live in those slums. And now, sadly, people who lived in those middle-class suburbs, they're falling out of the middle class. And those middle-class suburbs, those are no longer middle-class suburbs. Those are falling into poverty areas. A recent study was out that said that, you know, 44% of American families lived in middle-class neighborhoods in 2007, down from 65% in 1970. You follow the destruction of labor unions in this country, the destruction of income, the destruction of benefits. It's all right there, right in black and white, which is why the right is pushing their no rights at work agenda. Which is why they're out there day after day after day saying, oh, if we could just kill those unions, we could create jobs. We could steal, and we're up in New Hampshire, because they're arguing this no rights at work agenda up there right now. If we could just steal those jobs from Massachusetts, or in Indiana, where they're stealing those jobs from places like Michigan or Ohio or Illinois, if we could steal those jobs, it would make us better. And I had numerous musicians tell me, oh, you know, Rick, right to work states, they pull in jobs from everywhere else because they want to, those companies want to get away from the unions. So they go to these right to work states, and I ask the question, what happens when it's right to work nation? What happens when there's no more comparative advantage for a state like South Carolina to offer everything? Here's the land, the building, the roads, the permits, here's everything. Here's an education system designed for you. What happens when that goes away? Where's the competitive advantage? Oh yeah. It's who's going to work for free. Who's going to use prison labor? Who's going to use child labor? That's where we're going back to. That's where this leads. But the righties aren't going to tell you that. They know where this goes. They've seen this movie before. They wrote it. It's called the 90s, the 1890s. And we had better wake up. You and I had better come to the realization that the Romneys of the world and the Gingriches and all of the righties, all of the Koch brothers and the Scaifes and the moneyed class, they don't give a tinker's damn about you or me or my kids or your school district or anything. They care about taking their money out of your pocket because it's their money. It's not yours. It's theirs. And they're the smart ones. They know what to do. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk with our good friend Stuart Acuff. Stick around. Right back after this. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern
sang and rhythm been these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Working America is urging the White House and all 50 state attorneys general to hold big banks accountable for the mortgage crisis and not let them off with what amounts to a slap on the wrist. Working America's Christian Norton.
Mortgage banks and the state attorney generals are in a conversation right now to try to work out a settlement, basically to hold them accountable for the fraudulent mortgage practices that really put us in this economic strife that we're in right now. And we want to make sure that we get the best possible settlement for workers. This is really one of our last chances to get real relief for working families. There's about 7.5 million homes that are in the foreclosure process and another 11 million at risk. So the settlement has to make sure that it takes into account all of those families. It needs to be real accountability. And if we just go with a slap on the wrist, you know, that's not going to really help the working families. We need to have a full accountability. We need to have real relief.
A major Chinese manufacturing facility for Apple and Microsoft apparently is treating workers so poorly that they're resorting to suicide threats. Jesse Russell reports.
Workers at a Foxconn plant in Wuhan, China, have threatened mass suicide after the company announced they would be denying a pay increase. Foxconn builds electronic products for numerous worldwide corporations, such as Apple and Microsoft, and this plant specifically produces the popular gaming console Xbox 360. The employees were given the option of keeping their jobs without a pay raise or resigning from their jobs and receive compensation in exchange. After the workers quit their jobs and no payout materialized, 300 workers reportedly went to the factory, climbed to the roof, and threatened to jump. After a day-long standoff, the workers were eventually coaxed down by the mayor of Wuhan. Microsoft has said it will launch an investigation into the working conditions at the Chinese factory. Foxconn has a long history of violating codes of conduct it has in place with U.S. companies. In 2010, it was recorded that at the least 14 workers committed suicide due to labor conditions. The company produces numerous products, including Amazon's Kindle, Apple's iPods and iPhones, and the Nintendo Wii.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to the NLRB and other agencies.
Really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would
yes,
be.
Yes, if we could defund education. We could just have those, like I said earlier in the show, the robber baron who said, you know, I've seen children spoiled by education. They were spoiled for work by getting that education. That's why we need to keep them stupid. We need to keep them pliable, easily manipulated. During the break, I got an email from Larry. Never thought of the classless society argument before in that light. Thank you so much. As always, you are spot on. Keep up the fight. Great work in New Hampshire. They never stood a chance, and it's true. I mean, they don't understand the concept of what the NLRB is. They don't understand what their no rights at work agenda is going to lead us, at least the minor players that we talk to. The big folks at the top, they get it, and they want it. Anyway, I've got Stuart Akoff on the line. He's chief of staff and assistant to the president of the United Utility Workers Union of America. And he also has his latest book, Playing Bigger Than You Are, A Life in Organizing, which is available exclusively over at levinspublishing.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Stuart Akoff's name. Stuart, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick. I always love to be on your show. Thanks for having me on today, and thanks for plugging the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for what you do all the time and what you've been doing for such a long time to educate union members and non-union workers about what's going on in America. It's such an important service that you render the working class of America.
I appreciate that, Stuart. You know, we were up in New Hampshire for the primary, and what surprised me, and I guess it shouldn't surprise me, is how little the Republican, you know, minor operatives understand this no rights at work agenda that the right is trying to ram down our throats. And for me, at the end of the day, it's all about taking the rich people's money out of our pocket, because that's how they see it. The money that's in our pocket right now is theirs. They just have to figure out how to get it.
That is how they see it. I mean, they are determined to sacrifice middle-class families, working families, all of us who get a paycheck from somebody else, sacrifice our way of life, our standard of living, our kids' comfort and decency, our own sense of dignity and respect, to raise their profits and to raise the salaries of the CEOs and top-level executives. And they have been remarkably successful at doing that. I mean, we now have inequality greater than any time since the early 1920s in this country. Even inequality now is even greater than it was during the Great Depression, and it is drowning the economy. And you know, we can't rebuild the economy until people have money to spend, and it is totally anti-American what they're doing, because it's destroying the American economy.
Now, early on in the program, I was talking about this concept, and we keep hearing it now. We're a classless society. We're a classless society. And I keep going, well, you keep throwing that frame out there, but I hear everybody talking about this magical thing called the middle class.
That's right. Well, you know, the truth of the matter is that one of the strengths of this country, both economically and militarily, and politically, has been that we have had, since the 40s, we've had a large middle class that was built by unions organizing in the industrial sector.
What? Whoa. Hold on. It wasn't built by those benevolent corporate leaders, those captains of industry, those job craters?
Not at all, my friend Rick. It wasn't at all built by them. You know, workers got the codified right to organize in 1935, and I have to say this because of what these jerks in the Republican Party are saying. The Wagner Act, which became the National Labor Relations Act, was passed in 1935. It was upheld after a series of court cases by the Supreme Court in 1937. And it begins with a preamble that says, "It shall be the policy of the United States of America to encourage collective bargaining." Encourage collective bargaining. That is the charge of the law, and that is the charge of the board. So when these jerks say that, oh, the NLRB has turned into a tool for the unions, that's crazy. The NLRB is beginning to do what it is charged to do by the law. And so we can either be a nation of laws or not. You don't like that law, then try to change it. That's what, you know, Scott Walker tried to do in Wisconsin. It's what Kasich tried to do and it's going to cost Scott Walker's job in Wisconsin. It's what Kasich tried to do in Ohio. It's what Mitch Daniels Republicans are trying to do now in Indiana, and they're all going to lose. Because I think we're finally having this debate on the value of collective bargaining and the need for workers and people who draw a paycheck from somebody else, workers, the middle class, whatever you want to say, to have power in this economy. And without it, not only do our wages fall behind as they've been doing for 30 years, not only do our benefits decline as they've been doing for the last 10, 20 years, but we lose things like Social Security, which is on the cutting board. We lose things like Medicare, which is on the cutting board. We lose things like Medicaid, which is on the cutting board. We lose things like unemployment benefits. I didn't even realize this, Rick. I read today that Romney favors doing away with unemployment benefits and with some kind of unemployment bank account.
It's a voucher. It's the voucher system.
Really crazy to me.
Oh, it is crazy. But you know, here again, all of those things that you laid out, they want to assault, but they will not go after the corporate loopholes. They will not go after the tax breaks for people to buy jets and private country clubs and all of that stuff. That stuff's off the table.
That stuff's off the table.
But here's the thing. Let me ask you this, because, you know, and I wanted to get into the main reason I brought you on, because I've been saying for the longest time, without a union, an employer just comes in one day and says, you know what? I've decided that today you're going to work for 50% less. I'm going to take benefits back. I'm going to charge you more for your – without having a conversation, without having any type of negotiation. It's just imposed. Right. It's very authoritarian. This is what you'll get. Take it or leave it. There's your negotiations. Now, I understand people that you represent at American Water, American Water tried to do that with your employees, union employees. What happened?
Thank goodness the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, did its job and issued a complaint against American Water for unilaterally imposing benefit and wage cuts across the country. And we think that the company may be liable for $4 million in back pay.
So they took $4 million of money, their money, out of your workers' pockets, evidently.
That's exactly right, out of our members' pockets, either through wage cuts or benefit cuts. And in some cases, there is real evidence that they did that, not only in violation of the requirement to bargain, but in some cases, there's evidence that they did that to punish workers for being active in trying to get a new contract.
Let's say you
We've
didn't
been
have
negotiating
a...
with these guys for going on 2 years now.
Let's say you didn't have a contract. Could they impose that without anybody stepping in and saying anything? Let's say I worked for Bob's Water Company and Bob said, you know what, you're taking these pay cuts, you're taking these benefit cuts without a contract. Do I have any recourse?
Yes, if you've engaged in concerted activity, and this is the real nut.
Let's say I wasn't doing any of that. I was happy to be what they call a merit shop employee because I believed in my merit.
No recourse unless you could prove that they did it in discrimination against you because of your color or your ethnicity or because of your gender. Without a union, there is no recourse at all unless you can prove gender or racial discrimination. None. And I've been an organizer for a long time, and one of the most painful discussions I've had with workers over the years is the boss in a non-union shop does something bad to them, and they come to me and say, he can't do that. And I said, not only can he do that, but he just did it.
Yep.
And unless you get a union, there's not a doggone thing in the world that you can do about it.
Because it's a fiefdom. And
the difference, I have to tell you, Rick, and you're an old friend of mine, so this is going to be funny to you as it is to me. I don't know if your listeners will get the joke, but for the first time in my life, I watched Newt Gingrich on TV last night, and I agreed with something he said. He said, doing something legal is not the same thing as doing something right. And that's and he was talking about Mitt Romney and Bain Capital.
Right.
But that's the truth across our economy and across our society. When people expect the boss to behave well, there is no, without absent a union, there is no way to hold that boss accountable for what he or she does.
Yeah, I mean, it's a king servant scenario.
Absolutely.
You walk across that threshold, you are at his mercy. And that's why
it's not just benefits and wages, it's also employment. We live in a country of employment at will, which means if he doesn't like she doesn't like the way you address them in the morning because you haven't had your second cup of coffee or whatever, they can fire you for that. Because you make them uncomfortable.
Yep, and the only recourse you have is unemployment benefits, which people like Mitt Romney want to take away.
Exactly. I think the whole GOP still wants to take them away.
It's no longer the GOP, Stuart. It's the GO-me. It's all about me, man.
That's right, Rick. That's exactly right. It is the GO-me.
I got about...
Although, you know, it is kind of funny to watch them. I mean, my goodness. They'd be hard pressed to put up a bigger crew of stooges than this crowd.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you use the word stooge. I do believe that is what Romney calls you.
Of course, that is exactly what he calls me and calls you and calls people like us who believe in justice for the American people.
Last question I've got for you, got about a minute and a half. This latest book, Playing Bigger Than You Are, A Life in Organizing, which, like I said, exclusively available over at levinspublishing.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Stuart Acuff's name. Tell me about it.
Well, it's the story of the campaigns I've been involved with for 35 years, going back to community organizing in Dallas, Texas, and all through my career as an organizer. A lot of them are exciting. There's a lot of drama in the book, and I try to draw lessons from it. I mean, there's everything from community organizing in Dallas to building a state employees union in Georgia to being the president of the Atlanta AFL-CIO and having the fight to unionize the Atlanta Olympics, which involved a huge fight to electing mayors and members of Congress, to be in a UN election observer in Sierra Leone, the fourth poorest country in the world, to being the organizing director of the National AFL-CIO, including, you know, what I did during the split in the AFL-CIO, which was probably more written in this book about the split in the AFL-CIO than has ever been written, because I was in the middle of it always, the whole time.
I look forward to reading it, even if you are one of those people. And I don't even know if
what
I should.
What is one of those,
I don't
my
even,
brother?
I don't even know if I should be allowed to talk to you, being a community organizer.
I wear that title proudly. I was a community organizer for about 5 years, and you know, and I was fortunate enough to be the first organizer that John Sweeney hired in the Service Employees Union way back in 1982. And I've had the most rich life and the most satisfying and gratifying life any human being's ever had. I've worked with the best people in the world, people like you, Rick, all over this country. I've seen the country. And I've been able to spend my life working and or fighting for justice for average people. And I don't know any better way to spend your life.
There you go.
I'm remarkably grateful to the American labor movement and to Almighty God for allowing me to do that.
All righty. Again, the book, Playing Bigger Than You Are, A Life in Organizing, like I said, available levinspublishing.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Stuart Acuff's name. Well, Mr. Community Organizer, it's great talking to you.
Great talking to you. Have me on again soon. We'll talk more about the book, okay?
Anytime.
Great. Appreciate you, Rick, an awful lot.
All righty. Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Boom, bam. All together, USA. All together.
blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Let's hear it for American Tradition Partnership. It's an organization that stands up for the politically dispossessed in our land. It goes to the highest courts to assert the fundamental rights of a minority that's been denied its full voice in America's political and governmental power circles. Yes, American Tradition Partnership is a tenacious advocate for, cue the patriotic music, corporations. Huh? Despite its grandiose name, American Tradition Partnership is a front group that funnels money from corporations into various political ads attacking candidates whom the corporations don't like, without identifying the corporate backers. Hoping to expand its laundry services for these secret donors, ATP filed suit in Montana to overturn the state's century-old ban on spending corporate funds in state and local elections. The front group argued that the ban restricts corporate influence over government policies. Wow, that's so twisted and anti-democratic that it'd make an American eagle scream in pain. But for arrogant corporate elites and their political lackeys, too much is never enough. The good news is that corporate lackeys don't yet control Montana's Supreme Court. On December 30th, the court's majority sided with democracy, common sense, and State Attorney General Steve Bullock, who argued for the people of Montana that corporations already have beaucoup ways to assert their oversized political power without needing to funnel secret money into our elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the front group will now scamper to the corporate-friendly U.S. Supreme Court, pleading with it to stomp on this victory for democracy by overruling the state court and the people of Montana. To keep posted on this case and to fight for people power over corporate rule, go to www.freespeechforpeople.org. Freespeechforpeople.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
What they're doing, all of the GOMers running down to South Carolina. It's kind of interesting. I saw them, some of the polling data coming out. The one that pops out, John Huntsman was gaining some ground in New Hampshire. He's pulling up. He's doing better. He's behind Stephen Colbert in South Carolina polling right now, and pretty far behind at that. So if you're pulling behind someone who's doing it as a goof, maybe it's time to pack it in. Just a thought. But then again, South Carolina is a state where a third of the people polled believe in corporate personhood. They've bought the idea that they should have, that corporations should have the same rights that they have, which is kind of just mind-boggling. But then again, I think I expect that. Oh, man. I wonder if they believe we're a classless society. I wonder if, though, the folks in their middle class believe in a classless society, touting the fact that they're in the middle class. just a quick thought. I came across this article over at fastcompany.com. And what they're talking about is they're trying to make a case for shorter work weeks. And back in the 50s, there was a push to try and do this as well. Because there were some unemployment problems, you had a little recession that hit, so they were trying to make the argument, which understand is the reason that we had the 40-hour work week as well, which is why they said, okay, we're going to cap straight time work at 40 hours, and we'll punish you with time and a half over 40. Now, other countries around the world that we were meddling in, we set it up where you had a cap on hours, and that was it. There was no overtime. Understand, back here, we couldn't get that passed. Was never going to happen. The big bosses, the moneyed interests, were never going to allow that to happen. Because look, if you worked just 40 hours, you had time to do other things like read and stay informed in politics and participate And they don't want that. They want you believing what they tell you through that magical box. At the time, it was a radio, but now it's the TV. Got the magic box. And whatever they put up there, they want you to believe. And hopefully you haven't really thought it through enough that, hey, that sounds plausible. I'll believe that. And if you hear it enough, the repetition over and over and over, and if you're inundated and pounded and beaten, you'll buy it. Because you know what? Like they say about the big lie, you repeat it often enough, people buy it. So this guy's making a case for a 21-hour work week. And he's saying, look, he's written this piece over at the New Economics Foundation. And he's saying, look, right now you got people who are on this treadmill. They're in this cycle of work, make money, spend. Work, make money, spend. More consumption, more consumption, more consumption. And he's saying, look, if the globe consumes the way the Europeans do, or even, or heaven forbid, like us, there's going to be nothing left. There'll be no natural resources. There won't be the whole planet will be a garbage dump because we will have consumed everything. And what his argument is, look, instead of growing the economy, maybe we need to recalibrate society to make everyone a little bit happier and successful with less stuff. Like, I would love to have more time to sit and play with the kids. I would love to have more time to follow other activities. Now, they're not saying that we're going to have to make it that you can only strict, you know, our police, but that we should be starting to think of things in a little different way. Because after all, we're not doing the heavy industrial stuff that we did in the past. This was kind of the whole argument that they were making during the late 70s into the 80s to make us a service-based economy. They said, well, we'll have machines doing more of the work. The benefits will all, it will go across the spectrum and things will be fine. And that's what happened. What happened was machines did more of the work. People worked less hours. And the money that you were hopefully going to get to feed your family went upward. The wealthy folks, they collected all the money. We don't need labor anymore because we got machines. We no longer need you, Mr. Tool. We get our job done without you. But you'll still consume our stuff, and then we'll give you these credit cards, and you know the whole story. And I stopped and I was thinking about some of the arguments against it. And I remember, you know, the steel workers had in their contract a really smart idea. I think it was every 6 or every 10 years or something, you had the opportunity to take a 13-week vacation. Now, I think you got a week or two a year up until that. If you wanted to take that 13 weeks, I think maybe it was 6 years, if I'm not mistaken, every 6 years. And the thought was, you'll get a week or two vacation per year, and then you'll save up, and at the end of the 6 years, you'll have a 13-week block. And the thought was that we're going to get our members better educated. Because think of what a 13 weeks is basically the length of a quarter of education. That's basically how long a college course lasts. So the idea was these people would go back to school full-time. They would get better skills, and as they grew older, they wouldn't have to do this heavy physical labor. They would be able to have a second career after a number of years, and they would move on into something less physically taxing. You had labor who was thinking forward. It was a great idea, but then you had people who abused it and people who screwed it up and people who didn't get it wanting to go after it. I'm saying as a nation, maybe start thinking about let's bring those number of hours down so that we can spread the few jobs that we have to the people who are unemployed, like they do in Germany. You know, when the Great Recession hit, they didn't lay people off. They cut back on their hours. And they were paying into a fund that made up the difference in their earnings. So they were working less hours, making the same money, had a better quality of life. We're the only ones who don't think of these things. And maybe we do think of them because we did set those things up in other countries. We just wouldn't, it wasn't allowed here because the investor class said no. The veto power at the top. It had nothing to do with the president because, if you remember, Truman wanted a lot of stuff. He wanted national health care. He wanted stronger unions. And what did he get? He got major pushback from the investor class of this country. And they, over his veto, passed Taft-Hartley, which is where a lot of this no rights at work agenda came from. Because understand, the Republicans and a number of Democrats at the time pushed against it. Because they don't want you having time to engage in the process. They don't want you to have time to run for office. And I think about what Mitt Romney said the other day, which is just an absolute... He said, you know what? Somebody shouldn't run for office if they have to win that office to pay their mortgage. Basically saying, if you can't afford to lose the office, you shouldn't run. If you're not wealthy enough to take the time off and work, you shouldn't run. It should only be the elitists, and it should only be the property owners. It should only be that his class, the silver spooners. Doesn't that anger you? I know it angers me. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, going to look back 100 years today. What went on 100 years today? Stick around to find out. Right back after this.
I'm an announcer winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. You lose my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky. Desalination is the process of taking the salt out of ocean water to convert it into drinking water. An Earth Sky listener asked why desalination isn't in greater use along the U.S. coast, like California, where water scarcity is an issue. As yet, no full-scale desalination plant, that is a plant that produces millions of gallons of fresh water each day, has been built there. We spoke to Heather Cooley, co-director of the water program at the Pacific Institute. She told us the answer is complicated. Desalination has one huge plus, she said. It relies on plentiful seawater.
It's not dependent on local climate conditions. In addition, water produced from seawater desalination is very high quality. It's very pure water.
But she added, desalination can have drawbacks. For instance, she said, desalination plants can cost millions to billions of dollars to build.
But a lot of the cost is also in operating the facility. It also is very energy intensive, and that raises issues associated with the cost, but it also raises concerns about greenhouse gas emissions.
Cooley explained that it takes a lot of power to run a desalination plant because seawater, in order to be purified, is typically pushed through filters or membranes at very high pressure. But she added, the technology is improving. Desalination is controversial. For more viewpoints, come to our website and search on desalination. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
As we come marching, marching, 100 million dead, go crying through our singing their ancient cry for bread. Small art and love and beauty their grudging spirits knew. It's bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we come on.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. I gotta tell you, I was really kind of depressed that I wasn't able to stay up in New Hampshire for an extra day. We had to get back here to get the show yesterday and take care of some stuff, because today is the 100th anniversary of the Bread and Roses strike up in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And I've been through there, and the sad reality is the town now where all this stuff went on has kind of been abandoned as I remember it. And it's sad to see the productive capacity of this nation go by the wayside. So today, 100 years ago, these women, 30,000 women, took to the streets and said, you know what? You're going to cut our pay. We're barely surviving now. Enough's enough. We're going to the streets. And that's when all of the chaos, the police beatings, the militia beatings, even the women and children. But the most important thing about this, in my estimation, was the fact that you had people from 50 different nationalities, 27 different languages, all communicating for one goal, and that's to make their lives just a little bit better. That's why I've asked Professor Robert Forant. He is a professor of history at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. He's also the co-director of the Center for Family, Work, and Community. He has put together the Celebrate the Bread and Roses Strike Centennial. Breadandrosescentennial.org is the website. We've got it linked at thericksmithshow.com. Professor Forant, thanks for taking time for me.
Pleasure. It's been an interesting day, so this is a good way to end it.
I understand you had a nice outing today.
Yeah, we actually did a reenactment of the first strike walkout from the very same mill where the strike started, the Everett Mill in Lawrence. We marched from the Everett Mill about five blocks through the downtown to the City Hall, essentially occupied City Hall for about an hour. Couple of hundred middle school and high school students with us, the choir from Lawrence High sang Bread and Roses, we had speakers, and then we marched back and we opened a new history exhibit on the sixth floor of the Everett Mill, and that was attended by close to 600 people, so it was a pretty amazing day.
You know, and looking at this moment in history, and especially, you know, looking at the fact that we were up in, for the Republican primary, a party who is working diligently to pursue this no rights at work agenda to take us right back, in my opinion, and I'm sure, I'm not sure where you're at it, but to take us right back to 1912 or the 1880s, with respect to labor rights.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, one of the things about the strike that resonated at the time, and obviously still does today with so many commemorations all over the world actually today, a labor agenda was really put in front of the American public. We had gone through this incredible industrial expansion, late 19th, early 20th century, the formation of these large, you know, conglomerates, the Bain Capitals, if you will, of the day, and you know, it's really amazing. I found one of the proclamations that the workers issued right when the strike began. You know, and they essentially say they're using words like decent. We want a decent life. You know, it's just a very simple, very plain demand, but one that, you know, we're still struggling for today. So it's pretty incredible when you look at the strike and its history.
Well, tell me a little bit about the reason for it. As I understood it in my reading of the history, there was a law passed that shortened the work week from 56 hours down to 54. And as I understand this American Woolen Company decided that they're going to slash their workers' wages. And people just said, you know, enough, I guess, as I understand it.
Yeah, I mean, the wage cut is sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back. And so what basically happened is the governor of Massachusetts is thinking of running for president, and he's looking to appear somewhat progressive. And so there are a number of states that are beginning to cut the work week for women and children, and not to do away with child labor, but to at least cut the hours. And so the hours get cut from 56 to 54. They've been cut previously, a couple of years before, from 58 to 56. When they were cut then, nobody's wages were cut. This time, the companies didn't say, they didn't let the workers know, and workers are really living close to the margin. As it is, several worker delegations request meetings with William Wood, the head of the American Woolen Company, and other mill owners. The mill owners basically refused to meet with the workers. My suspicion is that a number of the mill owners sort of met in a smoke-filled room, all agreed they were going to unilaterally cut everybody's wages, and they didn't tell anybody until the 11th, when the first workers got paid and they walked out, and then on the 12th, when more workers got paid, then, things got really interesting. But, even before then, there had been efforts at organizing. There had been other strikes. The industrial workers of the world, were in Lawrence organizing, had organized several hundred workers at this point just before the strike. So there was a level of organization already. And at the same time, Lawrence had one of the highest infant mortality rates, highest death rates for kids under five anywhere in the country. A typical mill worker, if he ended up in a spinning room, odds are really high that he or she wouldn't live past age 25. So all these conditions were obviously really grating on people, weighing on people, in advance of the wage cut. And like I said, the wage cut sort of tips that's like the tipping point, I guess.
And who were these workers? I mean, as I've read it, you know, they're mostly women immigrants from other countries, and they were chosen specifically because they had different languages and they couldn't communicate across one to another, and that was actually exploited, as I remember in my reading.
Well, it's definitely, I mean, there people are obviously in the city from all over the world. It's truly an immigrant city on the eve of the strike, and definitely at work. People were pitted against each other by the mill owners. Different immigrant groups received different amounts of pay for the same work. People were, sort of congregated in ways so that they couldn't communicate with each other. But what happened is the city, there's 80 some odd thousand people plus all the mills, and it's only on 7 square miles. It's one of the most densely populated places on the planet in 1910, 1911. And so, you don't have traditional sort of neighborhoods the way you would usually think of them as well. There's a vast Italian neighborhood and a vast Greek neighborhood and Polish neighborhood. People are pretty much living on top of each other, sometimes even in the same tenement building. And so not so much necessarily solidarity created on the job, at least before the strike, but definitely solidarity created, especially amongst the women, just trying to figure out how to cope. And so women are watching each other's kids, helping each other stretch the food budget, you know, doing all sorts of things collectively, well in advance of the strike. So once the strike happens, these women already know they've got each other's back. They've been living this life, you know, of really, you know, essentially quiet desperation for all this time. And so they trust each other. And so that really becomes an important piece in the strike as it moves forward.
Let me ask you this, Professor, you know, in looking at today, you know, trying to compare the two eras, what lessons do we get from today? Because you see a lot of the same tactics, the divide and conquer. In fact, workers today, with the numbers of wages are falling. People are barely existing. They're surviving. They're not really living. We're surviving. So, I mean, there are some lessons for today.
Yeah, and I think the difficulty, again, is we don't have, the lead-in, as you said, you were up in New Hampshire for the Republican Tweedledum show. And, you have Newt Gingrich up there talking about getting rid of child labor laws so kids can clean their own schools. It's just incredible that 100 years later we're still having this conversation that there shouldn't be any regulation, that there should, you know, that minimum wages are not a good thing, the market should set prices. We see what happened in Lawrence in 1912 when we let the market set prices. So I think that's one lesson. The other lesson is I've been referring to the Lawrence strike as sort of the first Occupy movement in the sense that Lawrence really exposes the grim reality of industrial capitalism in America at the turn into the 20th century. By the same token, I think that a lot of the Occupy stuff really put on the agenda for people to have to think about this question of growing income inequality, this concentration of wealth, the dilemma of succeeding generations not, you know, getting better economically, that we're actually going backwards, not forwards as a society. And so I think there's a similar, I don't want to draw these real hard and fast parallels because I think people living in 1912 had a much harder life. You don't have the high infant mortality rate that Lawrence had now, although you probably do have it in certain parts of America, but nothing to the extent. So the comparisons have to be really loosely drawn here, but the strikers in Lawrence at the time forced the American population to contemplate this question of industrial capitalism and was it okay that we were treating working people the way we were. And again, I think part of the Occupy movement's power was that it was doing the same thing.
I agree. Listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Professor Robert Ford. He is a professor of history at UMass Lowell. He is the co-director of the Center for Family, Work, and Community. You know, we were in Wisconsin, back during the February occupation there,
mm-hmm. Yep.
when all that went on. And, you know, in talking to the people who were the first ones to get out, the first ones who sparked the whole occupation, they hearkened back to their labor education. They hearkened back to their memory of governors calling out the National Guard and what that meant in history. And I talked about this on Monday and Tuesday in New Hampshire with the rich history of that region. And just like you said, Gingrich saying child labor needs to be done away with. And I was talking to these people who said, well, we're better than they were back then. We don't need unions anymore. We're so much better than that. How would you respond to that?
Not going to happen. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I, I, uh, before I went into the world of academia, I was a machinist for 15 years, and I never saw any employer give any work or anything just for the fun of it. So that's not not on the planet we're on now. That's not happening. So, I mean, this question of wage inequality, issues related to workers' voice on the shop floor, worker dignity and respect at work, all those things, that's not going to happen, just because. I mean, there's the rare exception of an employer that's going to be like that, but that's not the norm. The norm is more like what it was in Lawrence in 1912. I mean, in 1912, they do call the militia into Lawrence. The mayor calls the governor, and the governor sends in the militia, and interestingly enough, I've been talking about this a lot today, one of the first contingents of militia on hand in Lawrence are a contingent of Harvard students who come to Lawrence to save capital. So there's a real delicious story there. Somebody really wanted to dig into it.
Yeah, and as I remember, the women sent their children to New York to live with friends and up surrounding areas to get away from the militia and the beatings by the police.
Yeah, and even before the strike, a lot during the work week, women, moms and dads would, because they didn't have anybody to take care of kids, would actually send kids away for the week, not so far away as Philadelphia or New York, and then get the kids back on the weekend. And the other thing that the immigrant strikers brought with them was there was a tradition already in European countries of sending kids away like that during a strike to be taken care of in a sympathetic, town next door or down the road or whatever. And so the strikers in Lawrence brought this tactic with them. And so there were several occasions where kids were sent out. It got a lot of publicity, favorable publicity for the strike. It made the mill powers in Lawrence crazy, and they tried to stop kids from leaving, and it backfired. They actually went to a train station on a Saturday morning toward the end of February. Well, there were about 40 kids and their parents waiting to put the kids on trains to Philadelphia. And the militia came in and the police came in and pretty much smashed up the people waiting in the train station, brought everybody to jail. Eventually they dropped the charges against people, but, it was a pretty rough scene, and the newspapers were there watching it and covered it extensively. It got really bad publicity for the mill owners, and it forced Congress to actually hold a series of hearings on the strike, and it really was part of what led to the settlement.
Again, I go back to the famous Jay Gould quote, "I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half."
Yeah.
Sad.
Didn't happen in Lawrence during the strike. Everybody stood up for each other. Also, at the same time, there was an incredible outpouring of support from around the country. We have at the Lawrence History Center all these records of people, of small unions in other parts of the country, individual workers, immigrants, social clubs, sending money in to the strikers. There were soup kitchens set up to make sure people got fed. Sympathetic coal guys on trains, as they went through Lawrence, would throw shovelfuls of coal off the cars, and kids would go down after the train went by and get the coal to bring back to heat up their houses and their apartments and things. And so the real really sort of a very powerful example of what can happen when people stick together.
Yeah, that is the history of unions. And, even today you see, I know a friend who works for the Sheet Metal Workers Union. They're doing the exact same thing. They're taking up collections to make sure that their unemployed folks have food and have money because their unemployment benefits have run out. Last question I've got for you. Do you see an awakening happening? Do you see this type of thing possible in the future?
Well, I mean, many, many people have worked on putting all this celebration together in Lawrence for well over a year. Lots of organizations in Lawrence, lots of individuals. We've gotten a lot of support, financial support for the exhibit from unions. And so people are really determined to, as far and wide as we possibly can, tell the story in hopes that it does spark a conversation and it does get people to actually consider workers do have power if they stick together. There really is a way to do things here. And that, this is a perfect example of, a bunch of immigrant workers who people thought would not organize, women workers who people thought would not organize, up against the Woolen Trust, which is one of the most powerful trusts at the turn of the 20th century in the country. And they stood up to them. They took their best punch and won. So hopefully people can learn something from that.
Again, the website, breadandrosescentennial.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Professor Robert Foran's name. It'll take you right there. Professor, I appreciate you taking time for me. Thanks for filling us in.
It's a pleasure. Happy Centennial Day.
Happy Centennial. Again, breadandrosescentennial.org. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight. And we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down. But I asked around. And everybody said, this is a union town. A union town. All down the line. This is a union town. A union town. All down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town. A union town. All down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833. And consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good and good to the ULL. Oh, now the good old union has come in here to drill. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
That question now has to be answered. I mean, if you look at the Romneys, you look at the right wing of this country, who is now... I don't know that anyone who can make a cogent argument that the Republican Party is not firmly in the pocket of the Koch brothers and the billionaire class. I don't know anybody who can make that argument. So it's obvious. This is, like it or not, this is a us and them scenario. And I hate that frame, because I would love to believe in that idea that we're a classless society, and that the Koch brothers and all of the billionaire class want the best for the country. That slogan that McCain had, country first. I wish that were true. It's not. What's true is me first, and then maybe you later. If you have enough revenue, if you have the advantage. Corporations are people, and I wonder what those tens of thousands of women and their families would think back in 1912 if we were okay with the fact that we were okay with corporations being people. I wonder what they would think. And you go back to that, the bread and roses strike, and it got its name because, look, you know, they wanted to be able to eat. They need bread. They need food. They need sustenance. They need to be able to pay their rent. They need existence. but also, you know, occasionally something nice. And the slogan was bread, yes, but roses too. Something above and beyond mere survival and existence. And I know so many people who are at that level right now. We're close to it. Struggling to get by. And you go back and you look back at our history. Some of the biggest moments in our labor history were women doing it, women and children. I think back to last year when the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire had its 100th anniversary. You know, that fire was because the bosses chained the door shut because they were afraid somebody might walk out with a scrap. Sad, sad, sad. Also today in labor history, Seattle Mayor Ole Hansen ordered police to raid an open-air mass meeting of shipyard workers. He wanted to prevent a general strike out there in Seattle. Of course, the workers were brutally beaten, and the strike began the following month. 60,000 people walked out in solidarity with some 25,000 metal tradesmen. It's that kind of understanding that my well-being is staked in you doing well. An injury to one, an injury to all. That if you're not doing well, I can't do well. That together we have to rise up together. That's completely the opposite argument that the GOME is making. The GOME is saying, hey, if we give everything to the guy at the top, he may sprinkle some pixie dust on top of us. We may get something if it falls out of his pockets. And you go, well, Rick, it sounds like you're engaging in class warfare. I didn't start this. I'm not the one who bought up companies all across the country, liquidated them for their assets, stole the pension fund, and cut those workers off to die. Mitt Romney was part of that. Gingrich was part of that. The investor class does it every day. It's just now it's part of our attention. It's in front of our faces. And the media can't be thrilled about it. Because who pays the bills? The investor class. Also today in 1942, President Roosevelt created the National War Labor Board to mediate disputes between workers and employers. Despite the fact that 12 million of the nation's workers were women, there were no men on the board. In fact, by the end of the war, there were 18 million women in the workforce, and again, no men on the board, which is why you didn't see any of the progressive changes that women were looking for. Help with child care, help with health care, whole bunch of things. None of that. Equal pay, none of that. Also today in history, and this one will drive the righties absolutely ballistic. Today, 1962, President John F. Kennedy signed the Executive Order 10988. Yes, that's the one that guaranteed federal workers the right to join unions and to collectively bargain. And when we were up in New Hampshire, that you could just see them seething. They were angry at the fact that those government workers have health care and they have pensions, gilded pensions. And I asked the one guy, you know, what do you think a state worker in the state of Pennsylvania gets for a pension? It's like 24 grand. And he's like, that's too much because I don't get that. And that's the problem. What's going on here? Even a meager pension like that is too much because the majority of us have nothing. And that's because we've bought into this on your ownership society. We've bought into this. The benevolent corporation will take care of us. We've bought into that. And shame on us. So there you go. Today's labor history. I think what Professor Foran said is so important, that we organize people by teaching them history. And I go to what happened in Wisconsin. That happened because of labor education, which is why you see all of these righties going onto school boards, making sure none of this stuff gets into the hands of the kids. None of this history is in any textbook because we don't want future workers thinking. We want them pushing buttons and doing what they're told and not asking questions. That's what we want. Anyway, going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Working America is urging the White House and all 50 state attorneys general to hold big banks accountable for the mortgage crisis and not let them off with what amounts to a slap on the wrist. Working America's Christian Norton.
Mortgage banks and the state attorney generals are in a conversation right now to try to work out a settlement, basically to hold them accountable for the fraudulent mortgage practices that really put us in this economic strife that we're in right now. And we want to make sure that we get the best possible settlement for workers. This is really one of our last chances to get real relief for working families. There's about 7.5 million homes that are in the foreclosure process and another 11 million at risk. So the settlement has to make sure that it takes into account all of those families. It needs to be real accountability. And if we just go with a slap on the wrist, you know, that's not going to really help the working families. We need to have a full accountability. We need to have real relief.
A major Chinese manufacturing facility for Apple and Microsoft apparently is treating workers so poorly that they're resorting to suicide threats. Jesse Russell reports.
Workers at a Foxconn plant in Wuhan, China, have threatened mass suicide after the company announced they would be denying a pay increase. Foxconn builds electronic products for numerous worldwide corporations, such as Apple and Microsoft, and this plant specifically produces the popular gaming console Xbox 360. The employees were given the option of keeping their jobs without a pay raise or resigning from their jobs and receive compensation in exchange. After the workers quit their jobs and no payout materialized, 300 workers reportedly went to the factory, climbed to the roof, and threatened to jump. After a day-long standoff, the workers were eventually coaxed down by the mayor of Wuhan. Microsoft has said it will launch an investigation into the working conditions at the Chinese factory. Foxconn has a long history of violating codes of conduct it has in place with U.S. companies. In 2010, it was recorded that at the least 14 workers committed suicide due to labor conditions. The company produces numerous products, including Amazon's Kindle, Apple's iPods and iPhones, and the Nintendo Wii.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
These are fighting the battles of the 1920s and the 1930s. And when we brought up things like the weekend or child labor laws, it's because things like right to work should be about as old a debate as they are.
To the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go. So as I said, you know, I was looking at all the stuff that's going on around the country, all of these attacks on workers' rights, this whole right-wing assault, this no rights at work agenda that they're pushing. And, you know, the people that I talked to up in New Hampshire, surprisingly to me, clueless to what they were doing. They were supporting it because the hierarchy told them they had to support it. And now in Indiana, the assault is going on there. And this, what's really amazing is you've got a party in this country who's saying we want smaller, less intrusive government, yet they want to interject government between an employee and an employer that they can't negotiate a security clause. That, to me, is remarkable. Anyway, I've got Sung Young Chow Morrow on the line. She's a national organizer for the Interfaith Worker Justice Group. She has been on the ground in Indiana since this assault began. Sung, I appreciate you taking time for me. Thanks so much.
Sure thing.
What's going on right now there in Indiana?
Well, as you've mentioned, this fight is full-fledged. There has been people constantly at the State House coming to protest the introduction of this bill. It's gone through the Senate, and it's up for vote in the House next Tuesday, and there has been very little public hearing or any information that has been made available to the public about this bill that's been that is being introduced and being voted on.
What's the argument that they're making that this is something that they have to do? I mean, you know, we were up in New Hampshire, and some of the arguments were just plain preposterous. And I'm sure they're the same ones, but I want to get it from you what they're saying, why this has to happen.
Right. And actually, the puzzling thing is that there isn't a lot of argument. The governor is just pushing this through and saying that this is good for our economy without really providing real concrete examples of what this would materialize. And, you know, he's making false claims such as, oh, you know, if this would affect bargaining rights, I would never let this pass, things like that. So it's not, you know, he's being very secretive about passing this through the legislature, and so that's what's causing alarm for a lot of people.
You would think that he would have learned from what happened just across the border over there in Wisconsin that, you know, hey, probably not the right thing to do to get people all worked up, because there's so many other things that need to be done, like creating jobs.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, on Tuesday night when he gave the State of the State address at the State House, it looked very much like what happened in Madison. I mean, there was line around the block. It took me, I waited outside 35 minutes to clear security to get in the building. And every floor around in the rotunda was full of workers that were coming to show their disapproval of what the governor was doing.
So as I understand it, he did go back on his threat to limit the number of people in there. Is that correct?
Yes, but, you know, as you can imagine, everything was moving very slowly. It took us a very long time to get into the State House, and then promptly people were being ushered out and being asked to leave the State House at 8:30.
You know, what amazed me about being in Wisconsin when they had thousands, tens of thousands of people in there is that you didn't go through a security line. The doors were open because it is the people's house.
Right, right. And in fact, actually, when I showed up at the State House, at one of the entrances, there were troopers standing there, and apparently it was a private entrance. And rather than just informing me that I need to go around to, you know, use the public entrance, he said, well, you can't enter through here, you know, as if to say, I can't get in. And I said, you know, this is a public meeting. I should be allowed in. He said, well, you can't enter through this particular entrance, you know. And so there was a lot of sort of trying to intimidate people and making it kind of confusing for folks to be able to enter. But, you know, at the end of the day, there were so many people. I mean, I don't think everyone got to get in time for the people's response to the State of the State address.
Let me ask you, as a national organizer for the Interfaith Worker Justice Group, again, the website IWJ.org, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Why are you involved in this? This is a labor issue.
Exactly. And we're involved because this is a labor issue. This is an issue of human dignity. And we believe that the core of all of our various faith traditions teaches us that we must value human lives over money and over economy. And, you know, the Catholic social teachings are very clear. It says the economy should serve people, not the other way around. And in fact, the Indiana Catholic Conference issued a statement in December of 2011, just this last month, that the Catholic Church has a long history of promoting worker rights and justice in the marketplace. And what we are trying to do is work there on the ground to get people to really, you know, live out what they're saying. You know, so many of our traditions have these well-meaning words about justice and what it means to stand up for people's rights. And I think this is a really, really great opportunity for people of faith to come out and live out what they believe.
Yeah, didn't you get the memo, though? The whole religion thing, not about peace and social justice. It's not about, you know, helping the poor, helping the sick. It's not about that anymore. It's about hooray for me and, well, you're on your own.
Well, we're trying to fight that trend. There are still a few of us that do believe at the core that the teachings that we have received from our prophets, our leaders, is about common good and about human dignity, and that's what we're fighting for.
And how would this, how does collective bargaining, how does a right to join a union, how does that meet that goal and that end, in your opinion?
Well, I believe that when workers have safe, protected environments to work in, that people thrive. And I think for us, it's really important to see, you know, that it's not hard to see that in the national climate that the politicians are trying to polarize this issue and make it about unions versus individual rights, you know, and that's not what this is about. This is about fairness. This is about fair conditions. And, you know, so many of our traditions teach us about self-sacrifice in order for the common good. And I don't think there's any better way to support that or live that out than wanting to see protection and common good for workers.
Wow. I just spent almost 5 days in the world of the right wing. I spent, we were up in New Hampshire for 5 days. And, you know, to hear common good and social justice and caring about somebody else, I'm kind of going into shock here, because that's not what I heard up north. That's not what I heard.
And I personally come from an evangelical tradition myself. And, you know, growing up, I heard over and over again that, you know, what we are called to do is to love the Lord our God with all of our hearts, all of our minds, all of our soul, and to love our neighbors as ourselves. And, you know, to me, that's been ingrained in me by my Sunday school teachers and by my pastors. And I just don't understand how you can live out that teaching when it's all about you and about your own well-being, regardless of other people.
Wow. So I'm guessing you're not a member of the GOME.
Probably not.
Probably not. So where do you see this thing going Tuesday? I mean, do you think they're going to have enough votes to pass this thing through? And what do you think the reaction will be if it does pass?
Well, you know, right now we are extremely encouraged and inspired by the courage that the Democratic legislatures have taken. And, you know, they have been absent at the State House, even though the Republican legislators passed this, you know, really ridiculous law that if you don't show up to vote and to prevent a quorum, you will be fined $1,000 a day that the official has to pay out of their pocket. You know, the Democrats have held out, and we have been encouraged by their courage to do this. And we're hoping that they will continue to hold out, not because they're trying to stop the government from doing its job, but to address the issues that are at hand. And so right now we are calling on religious community members and leaders in the state of Indiana to call their representatives and call for a moratorium on this vote. You know, I think the public and even the legislators themselves are not informed. We had a conversation with a Republican legislator who did not realize that unions would still have to bargain for members who aren't paying dues, for workers who are not paying dues. You know, they're not educated on this issue. They're just towing the party line. And so we're really hoping that on Tuesday that there won't be a vote, and that it would buy us more time to have public hearings about this and why this is, you know, why does the Republican Party believe this is so good and important for Indiana, and for us to be able to articulate why this is so bad and terrible for Indiana.
But, Sonia, we know it's not good for Indiana. You know who it's good for? It's good for Indiana Republicans.
That's right. That's right. And we need the public we need the Hoosiers to realize that this is not good for Indiana. This is only good for the Indiana Republicans. But there is no conversation happening. They're trying to move this thing through so fast that no one can ask a question.
Have they moved it so fast that there's no real polling data out there? Have you seen anything saying the way the folks in Indiana are viewing this right now?
There has been some polling, done, not a lot. And in fact, even on TV, you know, you're hearing oh, this is, you know, this is the governor's put out all these ads about how this is great because it's going to create jobs, but doesn't really specify why or how. And then, but the public polls, the limited poll that has been done shows that 41% disapproves of this bill. And in fact, it was really interesting. I was walking out of the hotel the other day and had a short conversation with one of the workers there. And he had mentioned, you know, he had asked me where I was from, what I was doing there, explaining to him. He said, oh, you know, I've kind of heard about this right to work thing, and it sounds like a really good thing. But, you know, I realize that it can't be a good thing because these politicians are being really secretive and trying to rush it through their legislature, you know? So it's like people, you know, the word right to work sounds so fantastic, sounds like such a positive thing, but even folks who are not educated are very suspicious of it. And so, you know, they're like, if this was such a great thing, then why don't they take the time to explain it and hold hearings to help us get educated about what this is about? Right. Like, this is such a great thing, then why don't they have a referendum that we can vote for it?
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, you can use those words, but there are no rights there, and there's definitely no work, which is why I've been using the no rights at work agenda instead of their vernacular, because it sounds good. Oh, it sounds wonderful. I've got this right. But there's nothing there for you. All it is a theft of your right and putting government between you and your employer, which the party that's pushing it is supposed to be against.
That's right. And you know, for all the talk of, oh, we need small government because government is so corrupt. I mean, what is going on in Indiana is corruption. You know, you do not inform the public. You are not being responsible to your voters when you're trying to rush this thing through without and acting like you don't have anybody to answer to. You know, they had a hearing on this past Tuesday where the hearing lasted for, it was a committee that was, you know, passing this bill through to have it voted on. And they wouldn't even read and consider the amendment that the Democrats were proposing.
Nope, just ram it through like thieves, like Scott Walker in the middle of the night.
That's right.
Amazing, amazing stuff. And I'm hoping that people see it for what it is, a theft of your rights. Sun Young, Chow Moro, I appreciate the time, National Organizer for Interfaith Worker Justice. I thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
All righty. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
But they slashed off London. They cut all their hours by Washington Decree. Here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did the fall become online? The president says they're tightening the bill. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Let's hear it for American Tradition Partnership. It's an organization that stands up for the politically dispossessed in our land. It goes to the highest courts to assert the fundamental rights of a minority that's been denied its full voice in America's political and governmental power circles. Yes, American Tradition Partnership is a tenacious advocate for, cue the patriotic music, corporations. Huh? Despite its grandiose name, American Tradition Partnership is a front group that funnels money from corporations into various political ads attacking candidates whom the corporations don't like, without identifying the corporate backers. Hoping to expand its laundry services for these secret donors, ATP filed suit in Montana to overturn the state's century-old ban on spending corporate funds in state and local elections. The front group argued that the ban restricts corporate influence over government policies. Wow, that's so twisted and anti-democratic that it'd make an American eagle scream in pain. But for arrogant corporate elites and their political lackeys, too much is never enough. The good news is that corporate lackeys don't yet control Montana's Supreme Court. On December 30th, the court's majority sided with Democracy, Common Sense, and State Attorney General Steve Bullock, who argued for the people of Montana that corporations already have beaucoup ways to assert their oversized political power without needing to funnel secret money into our elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the front group will now scamper to the corporate-friendly U.S. Supreme Court, pleading with it to stomp on this victory for democracy by overruling the state court and the people of Montana. To keep posted on this case and to fight for people power over corporate rule, go to www.freespeechforpeople.org. Freespeechforpeople.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, that's where you'd get the podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go with you. Also, you can email me here, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally and eventually. I saw this, and it's one of those moments where you go, there's someone in the investor class that you can almost like. Now, look, he's not doing it out of the goodness of his heart. And we keep hearing about Warren Buffett saying, tax me more. I should pay a higher tax rate than my secretary. We keep hearing this stuff and him saying, yeah, there's class war. My class is winning. We're winning it, but we shouldn't be. He's not saying it because, he's, this benevolent, wonderful person. He's saying because, look, at the end of the day, if we all at the bottom do poorly, he's not going to do so well. Eventually, this gravy train ends. Much like the no rights at work agenda that the Republicans are pushing. Yeah, if a state were to go, okay, we're going to turn into this anti-worker haven, where we're going to let companies come in here and exploit our people, that's only going to go so far until everybody in the country is doing it. Because we're pretty simple-minded. And, well, if only we could make Pennsylvania more attractive to business. And let them, cheat workers and all that stuff. If we could only do that, we could steal jobs from Ohio and New Jersey and Maryland, and we could steal them from New York, from Massachusetts. We could steal all those jobs, and they would come here, and they would make us fully employed. Now, the problem with that is it would be for less wages, and we would probably pay more in taxes because we would have to then subsidize those companies. So our standard of living would actually fall. And that's the natural progression that's going to happen here. And again, nobody has argued to the contrary. Everybody understands that's the direction we're going to end up in. Which is why when you look down south, they have a lower standard of living. It's because they're making less money. They have less health care. They have, all across the board. And, I think of Zach Womp, who famously, and I'm glad I kept this.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson.
Less health care, less wages, lower cost. You know what that lower cost is? That's you making less money. That's you being able to put less food on the table. That's you being able to... not being able to put clothes on your kids' back or a roof over their heads or pay for the sports that they'll want to play once they get into school or paying for their summer camp or whatever. That's coming out of your pocket. And like I said earlier, the investor class knows their money's in your pocket. They got to get it. And they're going to get it one way or another. So when I talk about Buffett in a glowing light, understand that that's the reality. He knows that if you don't have money, you're not consuming, his businesses aren't going to make a boatload of money, and he's not going to be profitable. He gets it. He gets the idea that in order for him to be wealthier, you have to have a little bit to buy his products, be it whatever it is, to make his companies profitable, whatever it is. Understand, Berkshire Hathaway, big healthcare company. So he's going to push for you to have healthcare, to make sure that you consume health care. So he came out and he said early on that I should have to pay more in taxes because, with my secretary paying a higher rate than I am, and I'm worth $50 billion, literally, I should have to pay more. So you had Mitch McConnell the smart aleck that he is, he says if Warren Buffett would like to give up some of his benefits, we'd be happy to talk about it. With regard to his tax rate, if he's feeling guilty about it, I think he should send it in a check. So, gotta love Buffett in this vein. Buffett says, okay, be happy to. All of you Republicans, all of you folks in Washington, every penny of contributions you make, I'll match it dollar for dollar. Buffett was asked if Mitch McConnell put his $10 million of worth into the pot, what would he do? He said would make the 3-to-1 challenge potentially costly. So he said, you know, we're gonna make sure that we get some money into the pot if the Republicans put up just a little bit, and he will make sure that he puts it in. For McConnell, he would go 3-to-1. Any other member of Congress, 1-to-1. Understand, this guy's worth $50 billion. $50 billion. So if McConnell were to put up his $10 million, that'd be $30 million. That'd be $40 million into the pot. Sounds like a good idea to me. I wonder how many Republicans will take him up on it. Just a thought. I don't know if you saw this. You remember, it was just a couple of days ago that Haley Barbour came out and said, you know what, we're gonna pardon more than 200 prison inmates. Get rid of them. Go. We're going to pardon them. In fact, including 14 convicted killers. So the state's attorney general argued yesterday that it's unconstitutional. Because evidently there's supposed to be a 30-day period. There's supposed to be some time frame where it's going to happen. Well, a judge issued an injunction saying, not going to happen. And, you know, you look at this, and I go back to all of these pardons that have gone on. The pardon, as I remember it, as I learned about it, was supposed to, you know, if there was an injustice, if there was something that, the governor or the president thought was some injustice that had happened, that's what the power of the pardon came in. Not political payback, not, hey, you know, I'm arbitrarily going to do this for one reason or another, but the right or wrong. I wonder, of these 200 people, how many of them were wrong? And yes, I know Bill Clinton did pardon a number of people, and I thought most of those were wrong, too. So no emails about, well, Bill Clinton did it. I know he did, and I didn't agree with it then. Also, if you've seen the latest CDC numbers and the list of things that kill us, for the first time in 45 years, homicide is not in the top 15. Pneumonitis due to solid liquids. Basically congestive heart failure, people drowning in their own fluids. That is number 15, replacing homicide. The number one killer, heart disease. Number two, malignant neoplasms. Number three, chronic lower respiratory disease. Then you had some accidents. You had diabetes, Alzheimer's, and suicide on the list, and a bunch of other really technical types of cancers and diseases. But homicide, off the list. First time in 45 years. So interesting numbers there. Also, they found out that infant mortality rates have fallen a bit from 6.39 deaths per 1,000 down to 6.14. So I guess that's a step in the right direction. Maybe we're getting better neonatal care, or maybe it is. People are just having less children. And we're able to take care of more of them. Finally, Southwest Airlines, they are fighting the Department of Transportation over this new ruling. And I think it's a good ruling. When you see these low fares on TV, oh, you'll fly anywhere for, you know, $99 or $79. Then you go and you do it. You find out it's much higher because they have tacked on fee after fee after fee and this and that and taxes and all kind of stuff. Well, the Department of Transportation said, you know what? When you advertise your price, it has to be what the person's going to pay. Well, Southwest, who I guess also owns Spirit Airlines and a couple of others, are asking the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia to block the proposed rule, saying it violates their First Amendment right to free speech. See, because they're not allowed to tell their customers, you know, this is how much we would charge, and this is how much the evil government charges. And for me, I say, you know what? It's a pretty simple thing here. There's a pretty simple way of going about this. You have a math problem where it says we charge you $900, and this is how much government charges you, but this is the final price. No surprises. Also, you know, they throw these baggage fees in and all this other stuff. You don't know how much their baggage fees are. Thanks to Southwest, I think most people know now there are massive baggage fees. You remember the story of I think it was Delta that was charging the people coming back from Iraq hundreds of dollars to bring their bags back, even though the military had negotiated a three bag free job. They will do whatever they can get away with. Amazing stuff. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Sky. Desalination is the process of taking the salt out of ocean water to convert it into drinking water. An Earth Sky listener asked why desalination isn't in greater use along the U.S. coast, like California, where water scarcity is an issue. As yet, no full-scale desalination plant, that is a plant that produces millions of gallons of fresh water each day, has been built there. We spoke to Heather Cooley, co-director of the water program at the Pacific Institute. She told us the answer is complicated. Desalination has one huge plus, she said. It relies on plentiful seawater.
It's not dependent on local climate conditions. In addition, water produced from seawater desalination is very high quality. It's very pure water.
But she added, desalination can have drawbacks. For instance, she said, desalination plants can cost millions to billions of dollars to build.
But a lot of the cost is also in operating the facility. It also is very energy intensive, and that raises issues associated with the cost, but it also raises concerns about greenhouse gas emissions.
Cooley explained that it takes a lot of power to run a desalination plant because seawater, in order to be purified, is typically pushed through filters or membranes at very high pressure. But she added the technology is improving. Desalination is controversial. For more viewpoints, come to our website and search on desalination. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, we just got back from New Hampshire yesterday, and I see this endorsement by Representative Lou Barlotta. And you go, you know, this is one of those things where there's somebody drowning. The last thing they want is a drink of water. But Lou Barlotta has now come out in support of Rick Santorum. He says Santorum's always been a good friend of mine for many years. He's always supportive, especially when I was mayor of Hazleton and we were going after those immigrants and we were making sure that we were making it illegal to be here. And of course, during his campaigns, he says that Tricky Ricky is a great leader and an incredibly hard worker. Yeah, he may be all of those things, but he refused to do my show, and none of his surrogates would come near our table. In fact, I had a couple people tell me that they were avoiding me, which that's no surprise for the Santorum people. Anyway, here to talk to us about what's going on around the world is the person who put together the wonderful event up in New Hampshire. Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Alan, thanks for taking time.
Well, maybe he's planning on running for senator again and he's scared.
No, I think he would take another thumping because people in this state see how completely radical Rick Santorum has become.
Well, that's for sure. Tomorrow it looks like somebody is going to, speaking of people, reveal some more information they have. This is a private equity expert. His name is Josh Kosman. And he says he's got some stuff on the real statistics on Mitt Romney that no one else has.
Oh, I can't wait to see this.
Yeah, that should be pretty good. So that's happening tomorrow morning.
But you know somebody was working on this. I think they were just working on it for the Obama campaign. Are you surprised that the Republicans have gone after Romney on this, considering most of them just,
well,
just yesterday?
Well, some people, even Tom Hartman said to me today, he almost thinks it's a little bit of a plant. And I said, no, I don't think it's a plant at all. In other words, get it out on the table and done before, you know, before the election. So then by September, oh, well, it's old news.
Yeah, but I think all those people that have been kicked out of their jobs over the years and all those communities who were destroyed because the factory that kept that community together, I think this story is going to continue on through the summer and into November.
I don't disagree with you, but I think that I can't imagine why people think the Republicans are organized enough to pull this off. I just think Gingrich is desperate, and he thinks this is how he's going to do it.
Yeah, it's like anything. You back someone into the corner, they're going to do one of two things. They're going to die or bite you, and Gingrich is definitely biting them.
Right.
So what's going on in the world? I saw this story about some soldiers really, I got to be honest, not good PR when you see a bunch of soldiers peeing on dead bodies.
Yeah. Well, Hillary Clinton came out just vicious against it. Leon Panetta did. And, of course, this is terrible timing because we're negotiating with the Taliban on a prisoner exchange.
Yeah, but at the end of this, I mean, isn't this what happens when you have, 10 years of war? Isn't this the kind of thing that happens when you dehumanize a sect of people?
It certainly is, and it's very hard to do that, and very hard to make soldiers aware of it. But you have to really concentrate. It's like sometimes when soldiers start shooting, they don't stop. They sort of get an adrenaline rush from it, and that is something I know that the military works on with people.
Give me your thoughts on this, because I got to be honest. There's part of me that doesn't blame them, the soldiers. They are put in a situation where their life is on the line every day. And we can say it's heinous, but we're not in the position that they're in. And there's part of me that understands it.
Well, yes. And I think that that they do. But I think that we do put our military in a terrible position, and we do stress them. And you know, one of the things Santorum said to me, I think you were out of the room at the time, was, well, you know, this don't ask, don't tell is going to totally destroy our military. We're going to have recruitment problems. Recruitment problems. With the economy at this point, there's not going to be recruitment problems. And they've, in fact, reduced the number of actually on-the-ground people in the military. And the fact is that in order to get in the military, they even want you to have some college, even if it's junior college.
Yeah, it's no longer like it was when I was a high school student, where it was the last resort. You know, the people who didn't have jobs or didn't have an opportunity to go to college or do something else, military was the last resort.
Right.
That has completely changed now because the economy is in such bad shape. And I remember back in '85 when I graduated from high school, it wasn't great then. But the sad, sad stuff. And what we should be talking about is jobs. And I guess John Boehner has come out. He has a proposal, maybe a jobs plan. Is this what's going on here?
Well, his jobs plan, Mr. Boehner's job plan, if you want to call it, is to take the Keystone and somehow get some more revenue from the Keystone pipeline and then use that to build bridges and roads.
So we're going to pipe the tar sands oil from Canada down to Texas and ship it overseas, and we could take that money and rebuild our roads. Is that the plan?
That's, I guess, the plan, as far as I can tell.
Okay, because, you know, there was part of me that was told that this was going to make us energy independent. What happened to that plan?
Well, yeah, I guess I've asked people, why isn't the oil being sold in the United States? I don't get an answer.
Well, here in this state, the natural gas that we're fracking for, we've got a couple of congresspeople who want to be able to sell it in China. I'm of the mindset it's ours. We should be able to use it. Let us buy it.
That's absolutely right. And we have to get ourselves to a point where we can be energy independent if something happens. And not to say that we couldn't turn on a dime on some of that, but it makes no sense to sell it.
none whatsoever. But again, it's not about making us into energy independent. The whole drill baby drill thing was never about country first. It was about profit first.
Right.
Just my thought.
It's often about profit.
Well, they are the profit.
But Newt Gingrich is doing our work for us.
Yeah, the Geomirs, they're all about profit.
Geomirs, I love that.
Yeah.
I'm going to use that if that's okay.
Feel free. The thing is, thank you for inviting us to the Radio Ouro. We had a fantastic time talking to crazy people.
Well, listen, that's what Radio Ouro's are about, crazy people.
And lastly, President Carter has a statement on the Egyptian military.
Well, yes, he's actually been in Egypt trying to sort of negotiate and talk about rules and elections there. As you know, he's a big elections guy. And basically, he came out and said, the military is not about to give up total power. They like their perks too much.
There you go. You kind of knew that was going to happen.
Oh,
didn't you?
Yeah, it's a 10-pound Robin fat, I like to say.
Well, good point. Alan Ratner, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. No, and, look, at the end of all of this, and you knew that was going to happen, that was going to be the inevitable outcome, are they better off? I don't know. Are they better off without Mubarak? We shall see. But today I was over at my doctor appointment, like I said earlier, and they had Pat Robertson on TV. And the vitriol, the anger, the jingoism, the Iranians are going to kill us. The room was full of people who were just glued to this stuff, and they're buying it. And I started thinking about the guy that I interviewed, the military guy from New Hampshire. I forget what his name was. Representative, it eludes me right now. But he was hell-bent on, they want to kill us. They want to kill us. And that's the message that they kept throwing out. And these people were buying into it. And I look at this thing with the guys peeing on the soldiers, or on the dead Afghanis. And you go, the messaging there from the other side is, the Americans want to kill us. And the part that this guy wasn't willing to concede to is that each side looks at the other and goes, they want to kill us. And I look at like somebody like Rick Perry and the other theocrats who want to turn this into a Christian version of Iran, and I go, we pursue that. What do you think the rest of the world's going to look at us like? I think kind of the same thing. But, yeah, I got to be honest. I went up and I told the woman at the desk, I go, did you really mean to put on Pat Robertson? He's a little crazy. And the woman goes, oh my goodness, that idiot's on? She ran over, turned it off. And then you could see the faces of the people sitting in the waiting room just kind of go back to normal, like they were human beings again. For that moment that they were watching him, there was anger. There was a snarl in their face. And this guy is the Christian leader. Isn't that worrisome? I mean, doesn't that bother you on some level that we've now got the people who are supposed to be spreading the good word, the word of Christ, basically pushing us into war, into killing people? What happened to the Ten Commandments? I had interviewed a Perry supporter that we didn't play. I think we'll add it to one of the podcasts over the next day or two if we can. Again, another person who couldn't tell me what the Ten Commandments are. Another, a Perry supporter who, if you remember, part of the big build-up to him announcing his run was going to one of these massive prayer service things where they had all kind of these crazy preachers coming in, and I think it was like 20,000 people showed up for this big religion fest. And I asked the question, he's a guy who wants the Ten Commandments anywhere. Do you know it? Evidently not. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this to wrap things up. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Rick Smith Show.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Making the blue blood see red.
The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Well, you know, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they don't want to be watched, and they're not liking it. They have filed a lawsuit against the Department of Transportation. Evidently, their claim is the Department of Transportation is withholding records that lay out how the U.S. Government is using these drones to spy on us. And, you know, we had talked about this a couple of times, you know, over the last couple of months, where, you know, they're sending drones into places to do surveillance work for one reason or another. And I'm going, I thought there was something where you're not supposed to use the U.S. military against your own citizens. It had some weird name, like Posse Comitatus, but evidently that's not part of it. Because when they use it against us, when the military uses these drones, evidently they say a prayer over it, and they, you know, they pat it three times, and they shake the wings a little bit, and that supposedly makes it a police vehicle and not a military vehicle. So then they can use it. So there you go. But they're filing this suit saying, hey, we want to know how often this is being used. We want somebody overseeing it. And I'm in favor of that. I think there should be some oversight into what's going on and what tactics we're using against our people. And in fact, you know, Iraq has been one of the great experimenting grounds for the police state, be it the sound cannons or the goodbye gun or any of the other number of crowd control techniques and gadgetry that they've come up with over the last 10 years in Afghanistan and Iraq. None of it good for you and me. All of it good for the investor class. Because understand, their main goal is to protect them, the investor class. We pay for the police, and we are the police to protect them from us. And I think about John Adams. You know, he used to look at us as the rabble. You've heard it, the unwashed masses, the rabble, those people, not us of blue blood and aristocracy. I know, but we're a classless society, Rick. We don't have blue bloods. I would argue we have green bloods, people who were born with more opportunity, with more wealth than you or I can ever imagine. But I'm being envious That's what it is, being envious. And I listened to Mitt Romney's little spiel, and I got to play it.
I think it's about envy. I think it's about class warfare. I think when you have a president encouraging the idea of dividing America based on 99% versus 1%, and those people who have been most successful will be in the 1%, you've opened up a whole new wave of approach to this country, which is entirely inconsistent with the concept of one nation under God.
And the American people, I believe,
in the final analysis will reject it.
Are there no fair questions about the distribution of wealth without it being seen as envy? Envy, though?
I think it's fine to talk about those things in quiet rooms and discussions about tax policy and the like, but the president has made this part of his campaign rally. Everywhere we go, or he goes, we hear him talking about millionaires and billionaires and executives and Wall Street. And it's a very envy-oriented, attack-oriented approach, and I think it'll fail.
In quiet rooms, we should talk about that. In the back room, in our cloak rooms. In the rooms of our think tanks. Talk about it in quiet. Kind of like we did with the whole no rights at work agenda. Kind of like we've done with the assaults on workers and voters and on the poor. Yeah. That's what he's used to. Talk about it in quiet rooms. Because we don't want people to realize that they've been getting screwed for 30 years. We don't want that. Because then they may say no more. They may stand up for themselves and say, you know what, we may want to do that collective bargaining thing that you keep telling us we don't need. And then we may want some of the wealth that we've given to you back. Because understand, the billionaire class that we've created, the money that they're sitting on used to be ours. Because it used to be the wages that they paid us to perform the labor to make their products and make them profit. And it's not envy. I mean, I love his analogy. Well, it's envy. I'm doing better than you are. You're jealous of me. It's not that at all. It's I want to be able to feed my kids, man. It's not about being jealous. In quiet rooms. Class warfare. And there he used it. One nation under God. One nation. Classless society. And that's going to be what you're going to hear from now until Election Day. They're going to hammer on that anytime Obama brings it up. And they're, unlike most liberal, progressive, Democrats, whatever you want to use, they find a frame and they stick with it. They find that perfect wording. And they've got the moneyed people to do it. They've got Frank Luntz, who I think is an absolute genius. Death tax, amazing. Amazing phraseology. And they stick with it constantly, which is why someone has to come up with something other than the right to work nonsense that they talk about. It has to be something more accurate, because there's no right. There are no rights there, and there's no work there. It has nothing to do with that. We already know you've got that right. You just don't have the right to get something for nothing. You don't have the right to me paying for your representation. You don't have the right to benefit from what I'm paying for. You have to pull your own weight. And that should be a Republican message. You know, I remember a day, and if I think real hard, I could probably peg it to the exact day, when the Republicans believed that people should take personal responsibility, that if they get something, they should pay for it. That if they want something, they should have to pay for it. Healthcare, for instance. There used to be a time when the Republicans believed everyone had a personal responsibility to healthcare. So the president goes and provides a mechanism for them to meet that personal responsibility, and they're not happy with it because they're not making enough money off of it. It's very, very interesting. Anyway, back to the idea of being watched, the drones. Understand the Real ID Act that was snuck in like thieves in the night. There's still parts of that they're trying to ram through. And if you remember back in 2005, Sensenbrenner tucked it into another bill, and it just kind of got tacked on. So under the Real ID Act, which will have RFID chips in all of the licenses that they issue, because I think it's 2013 where you're not going to be able to get on an airplane. You're not going to go into a federal building without a federal ID, which is the real ID. You're going to have the RFID chip. It's going to have to be there. And I'll be honest with you, it's scary stuff. Where you know, the military, the police, the investor class, they'll just drive down the street with their little RFID reader, and they'll know who you are just by pointing their little gun at you. And all the information's right there. Your full legal name, a signature for someone to be able to take, your date of birth, gender, a unique identifying number. Now you have a number. Not your social security number. You already got one of those, but another one. A number that we can identify you with. Your address and a picture. Full frontal digital picture where they can assign a number to your face so they can put it into their scanning system when you go to the ball game or you go to the mall. If I were the conspiratorial type, if I were the type that read a lot of science fiction when I was a kid, I would think we're living a lot of that. I would think that we're heading in a very, very bad direction. Anyway, I got an email today from Bernie Sanders, and I'm sure millions of other people around the country got the same email from Bernie. Not that I'm that special, but he's calling for folks to join in with him, the folks over at Daily Kos and Democracy for America, to pledge to overturn Citizens United. He says that he introduced a piece of legislation, a constitutional amendment, titled Saving American Democracy. It will overturn Citizens United. And in that piece of legislation, in that amendment, he says that corporations do not have the same constitutional rights as a human being. People have the right to regulate corporations. Corporations are prohibited from making campaign contributions. And Congress and states shall have the power to set reasonable limits on election spending, thus pulling some of the money out of it. So he's asking for everyone to pledge their support. We have put a link at thericksmithshow.com to where you'll be able to do that, to sign the pledge. And, you know, I'm hoping to see this go far. This is the beginning of the process to you want a constitutional amendment? I know a lot of people, we need a balanced budget amendment. No. We need an amendment to get money out of politics, especially money that we don't know who's giving it or where it's going or what it's doing. Karl Rove, he has pledged to spend at least $240 million this election cycle. $240 million. We don't get to know where that $240 million came from. It could all come from the Koch brothers. It could all come from crazy, well, wait a minute, it probably all does from crazy right-wingers anyway, and probably a good portion of it from the Koch brothers. You don't think that they're going to want something back for all that? You don't think that there's going to be, hey, remember me? I'd like, as the CEO and the owners of these gas companies and these oil companies, I'd like some deregulation of that environmental stuff. You know, because after all, it's the job-killing Environmental Protection Agency. You don't think that they're going to want something back? You don't think that they're going to want a little something, a little, you know? Again, this is radio, terrestrial, can't get too far. You don't think they're going to want something out of it? Of course they're going to want something out of it. And what it's going to be? It's going to be our health. It's going to be our safety. So again, we've got a link over at thericksmithshow.com. You can click on it and sign up for the petition. Because look, at the end of the day, the goal is to rein in and get people like you and I, average, everyday folks, standing up and saying, you know what, I'd like to run for office, even if Mitt Romney doesn't want you to. Because, you know, and that's pretty one of the most elitist things I think I've heard come out of his mouth. Well, you know, if you can't pay your mortgage without running for office and without the income from the office, you shouldn't run, is basically what he's saying. If you need the job to exist, you shouldn't run for office. I thought this was supposed to be a nation of, for, and by the people, not the rich people, the people. Anyway, have a great night. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
You've been been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain. Democracy is coming.